And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Millennial Woes, I believe you have an audio issue at the moment.
You sound like some kind of Pistoloid horror, Woes.
You sound like an alien race from Doctor Who. Back when the Radiophonics Workshop were doing an excellent job of producing that kind of thing.
I know.
There you go.
Is that any better?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah. We'll pretend that didn't happen, and I'll do the intro again. Welcome back to Millennial 2025. We're now doing the English Banquet. We did one of these last year, but I thought it was worth doing another one because there are so many content creators from England. So welcome, Newsfist, Survive the Jive, History Bro, and of course the Iconoclast, an old favourite, and Ryan Roger Athey, and Acceptable Frog. I think you'll know all these people from either YouTube or Twitter or Odyssey or wherever you know them from. All of us are quite spread out nowadays. So welcome, everyone. I guess we'll do introductions now. Why not? Let's start with Acceptable Frog.
Hello. Very nice to be here. Thank you ever so much for having me. I trust that you can hear me okay at the moment. We haven't done much mic checking so far.
You're good.
Sounds fine.
Wonderful. Well, so should I give a brief synopsis of who I am and why I'm here?
Yes.
Is that the general idea? Well, okay. I'm not sure there is an especially good reason for me being here, but it's a pleasure and an honour. I'm someone with an X account, so you know, I felt some sort of obligation to use that and tweet. So I've tweeted some tweets for the last couple of years. Peripherally, I've been involved with some of the people here over the years. I wrote a number of articles for Iconoclast back when he had his magazine, which was enormous fun. Yeah. Over the years, I've done bits and bobs of work for various people on what you might say the right or the racial right, including Jared Taylor, I suppose. If I'm known for anything, I suppose it's probably for reading two of his audiobooks. And doing my best to peddle those online, white identity especially. And I've inserted myself into various conversations over the last couple of years publicly, trying to do white advocacy here and there, various effects, I suppose, very varied effects. I've doorstepped Stefan Molyneux, as it were, online at least, not actually, you know, geographically, but... I was quite surprised this year to see he wasn't as willing as I expected to engage on race, but well, okay, there we are. I suppose that's for another discussion. What else has gone on? Well, you know, had a few successful tweets that did reasonably well, and and here I am. There are one or two other things that could be said, I suppose, but it's brief introductions to begin with. So over to the next human.
Thank you. Ryan, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here, and it's very nice to be on the furthest to the right of the screen. I'm sure that's not deliberate at all. But hello, everyone. I hope you're all doing well. It's great to see you all watching today. My name is Ryan Roger Athey. I was the host and founder of Reality Based until YouTube wiped me out in May of this year, which is fine. It was inevitable considering where things were going. I haven't been on a panel show for months now. Most of what I do now is behind the scenes stuff. I'm helping a new creator in this space get his start, and he's doing a very good job. The dignified cartoon gentleman. Hopefully he will succeed where I have failed, but it's great to be here with this fantastic panel of fellow creators, and it'll be nice to actually be in front of the camera for a change.
Okay. Yeah, the arrangement was simply so that it was symmetrical. That was all I was thinking of. Iconoclast, welcome back.
Hello, lovely to be here. I think this might be my sixth or seventh time on Millennial. I'm not quite sure. I've been on here quite a few times. About me, let me think. Let's think. Well, I am arguably the greatest British nationalist content creator of all time. The GOAT, if you will. That's not me saying that. Other people say that. People on X say that all the time. The Observer says it all the time. The Guardian says that. So, I mean, I'm just here as a humble former content creator who is ready to have a nice chilled out conversation at Christmas time. And what's next for me? I guess people want to know that. I'm getting into celeb boxing. My first fight was supposed to be against Horace, but I've realized he hasn't turned up tonight, so he's running scared already.
He said he had the flu, but I didn't believe him.
Right. Well, that's an excuse, isn't it? Someone needs to stop him, and that someone is me. And, you know, come on, Horace, stop being a coward. But yes, I'm very much looking forward to chilling out tonight. Welcome to the panel as well. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Yes, Merry Christmas. Tom, please go ahead. I'm sure everyone knows you, but anyway, nonetheless.
Some may know me by the name of my channel, Survive the Jive. I am a content creator since 2006. I started my YouTube channel, so I'm really old in the game. But I'm known for like doing history stuff. I used to do esoteric stuff. And I'm one of the original millennial guests. I think I first came on 10 years ago. I can't remember. The first time I did one was with Grog and Yarnifer, and it was a discussion of Yule and Saturnalia. I believe that was 2015 or 16, but it's all been scrubbed for the internet now. I don't even know where it's gone. So I know that on Odyssey, you've got me going back to 2017. I didn't come on last year, so I have had not a constant 10 years. I have missed a couple, but yeah, here I am again, just making an appearance so that I can keep the side up and meet some nice English people on this winter's eve.
All right, excellent. Thank you. Bo.
You all right, mate? How you doing? It's good to be on. This must be it's either my second or my third time. I can't quite remember, but I wasn't on last year. Gutted about that. But thanks for having me back on. I appreciate it. Yeah. I mean, Iconoclast says he's sort of the most famous here. I mean, it's obviously me. The most No. I think Tom, Survive the Jive's got to be the most eminent, I would say, on this panel, in my opinion. But yeah, people can find me all over the shop. I'm in danger of being like oversaturated, if anything. You can find me on the Lotus Eaters, the podcast of the Lotus Eaters. I'm on there a couple of times a week, usually on the main podcast. But I've also got my own show behind the paywall there, Epochs, which is history themed. I'm knocking 245 odd episodes of that, a few hundred hours of just history themed content there. But I've got my own channel, History Bro, which is just history content. I've also got another channel with Mr. H Reviews, you know that fella, Mr. H Reviews, The State of Politics, where we just chat about politics. And I appear on other people's channels from time to time. So yeah, there's the internet's a bit too much of me, if anything. I've got another show starting at the beginning of January, on the 5th of January, on the Lotus Eaters, free, unpaywalled, in the breakfast time. Breakfast with Bo at 8 a.m. every day, 8 to 9 a.m. We'll be talking about that day's news. I'm even wearing a T-shirt. I've got a little logo. Can you see that?
Nice.
Anyway. Nice. Anyways, the eyebrows there.
The people's eyebrow. The Bo brow. Ridiculous.
Let's
ridiculous
see it again. You can show that logo again. Show the logo. Let's see it. Right. Okay. Yeah, okay.
You get it?
Excellent.
You get the gist. So that's it. Thanks for having me on.
This right. absolute grifter shilling his own merchandise on this stream. Unbelievable. And by the way, you were on last year because we were on this very stream last year, the English Banquet, and I got royally pissed and I can't remember anything about it. So that's... We did do that last year.
That's right. And Horace was with us. But yeah, as he said, because I'm very good friends with Horace, IRL. And yeah, he's ill. I didn't know he's boxing. Surely you're making that up, Iconoclast. He's not boxing. He's not a fighter. He's a great guy.
No, it's going to be on Netflix. It's going to be a thing. Don't worry about it.
All right.
And Newsfist was on the Australasia banquet yesterday. But nonetheless, brief intro, please.
Hi, I'm Newsfist. You can find all of my links at newsfist.net. I used to cover mainly UK news, but it has been so horribly depressing. I decided to pivot to doing sort of like weird medieval history. Usually the show would actually be right now, but I skipped it off for tomorrow because it's such an important thing. We're covering the Anabaptist rebellion in Munster when the Anabaptists decided to do a little communism back in the 1500s, which is a crazy story. But what I'm much more known for is my live stream with Rhetorically Defective, Artie and Fist, that's on Fridays at 11. And at the moment, we are mainly covering what's going on in the right wing in US politics and the sort of conceptual battle with US Zionism, which is a crazy story that doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon. Thanks for inviting me, Woz. It's always a pleasure to be here, mate.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Okay, Bo, I have watched a lot of your videos with Mr. H reviews, but I now can't remember the name of the channel off the top of my head, and I watch it almost every day.
State of Politics, it's called.
That's State it, the State Politics. State of Politics. I thought it was State of Nation, but then no, that's back from
old school 2014.
Yeah, Tom remembers. Yeah. Yeah, that's a long time ago. Let's start with Tom. I think that this has been a pretty good year all round. I mean, obviously in Britain there have been a lot of scandals, debacles. This latest thing with the guy, it's just another one. They've squeezed in another one, another insult to the public before the end of the year. But there have been quite a few this year. But nonetheless, I would say it's been on the whole a very good year for nationalism. What would you say?
If I could go back in time and speak to my black pill self in 2012, living in Tower Hamlets in Whitechapel, I don't think I would be able to convince myself how bad and how good it's got. Like it's simultaneously much, much worse. Like the actual demographic and political situation, like actual quality of life, like the country is falling to pieces. The NHS, everything is just rubbish. It's never been worse in my life. But for the first time in my life, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There is an actual route to change. There is a potential antidote to the sickness. And that I never saw in any point in my life previously. And I've been involved. I mean, I first was probably like right wing back in 2003, and I first became active around 2010, 2011 or something like that. But nothing like this I anticipated. And it's all, I mean, it seems to be just the opposite of what everyone said, this isn't real life, X isn't real life. But I think, so this is largely driven by social media and the shift or away from legacy media to being the main source of news. And Elon Musk has driven it. Even Musk has delivered it to us, a potential. Props to him for that. And Rupert Lowe, I think, by being an MP who's willing to bring these talking points into, the mainstream spheres, has done a great job as well. So I think, I don't want to hog the mic, but those are the main things that the last year that really struck me as like, historically significant.
Yeah, that's a very good summary. I think it's increasingly ridiculous when people say that Twitter isn't real life. I mean, it clearly is. it clearly is having an impact on public discourse. Bo, would you like to chip in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. People say Twitter isn't real life. That's cope for people that are losing, really. Twitter is very much a reflection of real life. I mean, if you could be prosecuted for things you say on Twitter, how isn't it real life? It certainly is. I think Tom made a really good point actually about Elon Musk. I'm a fanboy of Musk. Mostly it's tongue in cheek, right? Mostly it's tongue in cheek because he's not perfect and he has had loads of takes that I profoundly disagree with. But when he bought Twitter and took it over and has allowed, not exactly free speech, but, you know, a much further degree of freedom of expression on there from what used to be, certainly, that was a game changer. That really is a game changer, I felt. I'd also mirror what Tom said, that, it's both simultaneously what the whole situation, broadly speaking, is much worse than it's ever been. And yet there is light at the end of the tunnel. I'm trying to halo myself there with the light behind my head. There is light at the end of the tunnel. I think it's inevitable. When you look, I don't want to hog the mic, but when you, if you like take a sort of dispassionate, broad view of history, it's inevitable that there will be a reaction. Leftists like to call us reactionaries, don't they? I'm happy to be part of the reaction to socialism, communism, globalism. There will be a reaction. There's no way around it because people have got a breaking point. Even normies, they will eventually wake up in enough numbers that there will be a significant reaction to all of this insanity. I honestly do think it's inevitable. I don't think that's a cope. It has to be.
And the other thing is that if Twitter isn't relevant, then why does every politician want to be on there, even when they say they're going to disappear to blue sky? Every celebrity, all of the lobbyists, the campaigners, the academics, why are they there? I mean, you could say it's just an irrelevant talking shop and the decisions happen elsewhere. I think that's true to an extent. And yet still, what happens there seems to be relevant.
It's the preeminent forum, I think.
If I might interject, I think, I mean, for a start, if Twitter isn't real life, then why is so much effort put into controlling it? I mean, during COVID, the administrative elite got everything they wanted, really. You know, they could control narratives at a word, take down people. I think the real problem with Twitter is narrative endangerment, essentially. The cultivation and the allowing to form of alternate narratives. And you're seeing this a lot. The Egyptian activists that came over, for example, and everyone's like, you know, rah, 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 rah. And of course, Starmer comes out and is like, oh, yes, those anti-Semitic remarks were terrible. And everyone's like, yeah, you know, he called like for killing all white people as well. But and I think this is a very, very powerful narrative that's forming. It seems that there's been a lot of effort put into stopping whites from collectivizing as an ethnic electoral bloc, because that would give them, you know, given the numbers situation, even though it's quite dire in the UK, if whites did actually form a sort of cohesive electoral bloc, that would still give them significant influence. And that seems to essentially be the darkest of all nightmares for the administrative elite. I mean, you know me, Woz, I'm generally quite black-pilled about everything. But I do think that is a potential path to power, which shouldn't be underestimated.
Ryan, do you have any thoughts on this? I see your eyebrows moving quite animatedly.
Yeah, I always like using facial expressions. It's what I'm famed for. But I will make it quite clear in regards to this situation. Despite the fact that I look like a 40-year-old, I'm 26 years old. I've practically grown up over the past 10, 15 years through this cultural shift, okay? The bread is moldy and the circuses are crap. Add that to the fact that our Western world is deliberately going down the drain, and of course it's going to annoy and frustrate a lot of people. And I think, as time goes on, and we don't have a lot of time, but as time goes on, more and more people will realize the problems and they will join together to find solutions and be the change that they want to see. And we're starting to see the effects of that. And personally, I've always believed that the UK is always 10 years behind the US. I know where the UK is going to go because the US is already going through it. And that might be good news to some people and bad news to other people, but I do think the tide is turning and things will go our way collectively in the future. And it's going to be one hell of a backlash. I'll tell you that. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. About a reaction and that being sort of to some extent, it's unignorable. I see this with Rupert Lowe. And again, it's only started. I think it began in April, May this year. And hold on a second. Acceptable Frog is there. He is right. It started April, May this year, and already it's a very clear voice in the discourse. And if that were to keep growing, if it were to become, say, I don't know, 500,000 on Twitter, I don't, at that point, how is the establishment going to ignore it? How are they going to just claim that it doesn't matter? And so to that extent, I think people, I hate the phrase, but people power does seem to be a real thing. Again, with the protests with Epping and Southport and everything that's happened this year, the public see that. The mainstream media have no choice but to, I mean, they tried for a long time just not reporting this stuff. But at this point, even that hasn't worked. So there is a frame game going on. But even then, the general public seem to remain continually pissed off. And, you know, and some people think that's deliberate, that's engineered, that the regime are doing things deliberately to piss people off. But I don't see why. I don't see how that could possibly work in their favor. I think that might be overthinking it. Tom.
The conspirational angle, which I don't object to in every case, but has been losing this year on several fronts, especially those who were trying to say how the flagging was a way of misdirecting energies and everything. I can't tell you how delightful it was to drive around rural Devon and see flags all over every village. And then if you enter a town, see graffitied, I'm not a big fan of graffiti, but it was just very encouraging to see it. And then when I drove all the way to London and I see it all the way across England, there's flags all over the place. It just gives you a sense of the scale of how many people that are actually feeling this way. It's not a little thing and it's not something they can just put back in the box. It's out now and it's massive. And the constant like presence of the flags this year made me reassess because I had admittedly in 2020, my general opinion about the political potential of the general public was greatly diminished when I was dismayed to see how, how submissive and obedient to like the dictates of the lockdowns and stuff that people generally were. There was nowhere near enough civil dissent for my liking. But then I think this year that there has been a change, starting with Southport last summer, but just gaining momentum. And even, although I'm not a great fan of him, Tommy Robinson, I did attend the Unite the Kingdom protests in London, and the atmosphere was quite electric all over London to see thousands and thousands of people, millions if you believe Tommy, but I don't know, I'm not quite sure about those numbers. But definitely tens of thousands. And very, very, this is something that is not being controlled entirely by anybody. It's something that's quite organic. And there may be various different factions. There are indeed many factions trying to direct it. But I just think that you can't, not if there are a shadowy elite who control everything, then they're losing their grip. Or maybe there's a much more complicated model of power required to understand what's happening.
I think that's really the crucial question there, Tom. How are we actually governed? Like, what is the power structure that governs us? This is probably the central question that has occupied my mind for, I don't know, a really long time. Obviously, everyone knows how it is that it is said that we are governed, right? You just go to university and they'll tell you, yes, the Houses of Parliament and the democratic vote and all this kind of other stuff. But increasingly, it seems that that's not really how we are governed at all. And the appeal to the shadowy elite, I think, is always a bit, you know, sort of loaded language. Who says the elite are shadowy? They don't seem to be very shadowy at all, actually. It's quite obvious who they are. I think what people don't understand truly are that there are multiple different principles of governance, and some of them involve outright skullduggery. So, for example, importing migrant populations because they will vote for you, engineering a system in which two voting blocks in a country are equally matched so that a small, highly coherent bloc can be the difference in either case, you know, like being on the middle of a seesaw. The possibility of using certain communist tactics to make sure that there is enough resentment in the population so that if anything needs to be done, it can be done quickly. Narrative warfare, all of these things, like they are said to be conspiratorial, but they're not really. They're just technologies of governance that do not suit the way that most people believe that we are or should be governed. I personally think that what's likely to happen is that we're going to go to war with Russia. And once that kicks off, the field is going to shift considerably. The narrative field is going to shift considerably. What the government can do with its powers is going to shift considerably. The elites love to sort of talk about this idea that those that oppose them are a small, vocal minority. They never come out and say precisely what percentage of the population this small vocal minority is, because it might give lie to the fact that really it's just a cope. They know that everyone's pissed off, but they're also sort of locked into their governmental frame that they don't like. I don't think people really appreciate how much not only the elites hate people like us, but regard any kind of win by such people like us as a sort of an existential threat. You're letting the chuds win, you're letting the racists win, you're pushing back against a diverse society, or you know, you're letting hate divide us. All of this stuff has an incredibly strong narrative frame, and even though groups like Hope Not Hate and Stand Up for Racism are sort of taking a pounding in the narrative sense, they do still exist. They still have interfaces with, you know, police and intelligence. They're sort of like a third sort of arm of government that have governmental abilities, but are not governed by the rules that would govern governments, if that makes sense. I don't know. It's very, very fluid. I just think it's a lot more complicated than a lot of people make it out to be.
Well, it's definitely more complicated than I realized it was. And that realization came in 2020, as Tom said. You realize how bovine the public are, or were at that time, and you also realize how resourceful and, well, persistent and ruthless the regime is. About war with Russia, that seems like a good topic to move to, because I can't see this happening. Who wants to take this?
Well, I've got something to say about, sorry, Bo, I've got something to say about the Russia thing and what we just talked about with X. Let's just go back to X for a second. I think that when people say, oh, X isn't real life, okay, but I do think it is a big signifier of what people are thinking and where things are going. I mean, you just mentioned COVID there and the lockdowns. Imagine if this version of X existed back then. I don't know how far that sham would have gotten, really. And the reason why the COVID thing lasted as long as it did is because everything was so heavily censored and curated and controlled from the top. Now, I mean, you can think what you want about Elon Musk. I mean, he's not perfect by any means, and people are suspicious and yada, yada, yada. Fair enough. But what I've seen this year on X is the issue of European identity become front and center, really, in a way that it hasn't before. I mean, obviously, we're all in the same kind of circles. We've been talking about this for years, but I've seen it transcend that and become not mainstream, but it's getting there. And it's becoming
pretty
bigger.
Much. It's yeah, definitely yeah. Getting there.
Of course. I mean, when you've got, I mean, for fuck's sake, when you've got Piers Morgan interviewing Nick Fuentes, it's unbelievable. I mean, this is how far things have progressed, right? And the issue of identity itself has become front and center. And just on that, if I can make a quick sidetrack here, Wolves, I'm disappointed that you don't have the Scottish banquet this year, because I've had an update in my Ancestry account, and apparently I'm slightly more Scottish than I am English now, which is weird. I just don't think they understand the northeast of England. I think they don't really know how to categorize that. But either way,
it's weird because I think I was researching Biker Grove about a year ago. I don't know why. Some of you will be familiar. It was a thing on BBC, children's BBC in the 90s.
Mind-bending last episode.
The point is, I saw these photos of the cast, and I thought, that could easily be a bunch of Scottish kids. It could easily be a bunch of Scottish kids, right? The phenotype is extremely similar between the northeast of England and... Well, certainly that, you know, the northeastern corner of England and Scotland. I was really quite struck by it. It never occurred to me before.
Southeastern Scotland was part of the Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Northumbria. Just want to make sure everyone's aware of that. And it's English clay.
And I heard these recordings of World War I soldiers. I think they were recorded by Germans for infiltration purposes. So it's this Newcastle accent from 100 years ago, and they were saying feyther. And that's Scottish, right? That's how broad Scots say the word father, feyther. And I thought, wow, that's it's just one small obscure thing, but, you know.
Scots is a Middle English dialect, a derivative of Middle English. So it's like all the Scots words are basically just older English words that are less common in other English dialects anyway. But I guess that's...
right.
Tangential, going off topic now, aren't we?
It's very interesting. I mean, I think, but again, I was disappointed that you didn't have the Scottish banquet because I think I could have jumped on both of them. And but needless to say, my kilt, my Buckfast, and my heroin is in the mail, and I'm looking forward to getting stuck in with my new identity. So
deep fried heroin.
That's a good start. It's a good start. But until you're having a fried Mars bar, and you know, you're just a tourist.
William Wallace.
You can you have a junkie in the Grove? Can you have a junkie in the Grove? I remember Biker Grove. It was well good. I really fancied Donna Eyre. Do you remember Donna Eyre? She was it. She made a break in. Anyway.
There are a few cuties on that.
A number of.
Sorry, I didn't want to derail the thing. Duncan.
No, you didn't at all. There's a very interesting YouTube channel, Stuart Millard, who goes over retro television from the UK of that era. He's included Biker Grove, in fact. And it really is quite fascinating now, looking back at old British television of that era with a current perspective, having gone through the mill of racial identity and various discussions online, because you see it now for what it is, at a time during which the UK was, you know, basically a white ethno state still up until the late 80s.
I'm pretty sure that's what I grew up in. I mean, that's what it seemed like.
It de facto was, in terms of raw statistics. And yet there was this endless procession of black and Asian and Indian Pakistani children being thrust in front of the camera. Every children's TV show had to have this quota. It was like DEI before DEI.
I tried to put on for my children old 80s stuff from, you know, from the 80s of the BBC, and I realized, like, very black, like specifically blacks. And like the population even in the early 90s was over 95% white, and
well, up until 1997
I don't know how many were black, but it's like 1 or 2% but definitely
well, we were 94%,
25% black or something on 80s children television. Easily,
no, you're, that's right, Tom. You're not. That's not an exaggeration. We were 94%. No, let's get this right. Actually, yeah, we were 94% white up until about 1997.
Right.
And in terms of, you know, births of children to two white British parents, at least. It's one of those statistics, if not the raw population statistics. I have to go back and check. Paul Weston was referencing this. But that's the point, you see, that why that's especially relevant is during that time, you realize then that our institutions, our media, was not putting these children in front of the screen because they were in any way representative of reality. That was being normalized. That's racial.
Social engineering.
It's pure social
Chris Akabusi, Andrew Peters, like loads of them were like, it was constant. No, like right. A lot of black people were
the harmless. They were the benign blacks back then. You know, they weren't rapping and raping and all the rest of it. They were speaking proper bloody English as well.
Chris Akabusi was saying a wooga though.
What does that mean? Does that mean kill the white man?
Does that even mean? There's a number of good points that were raised though. Like one was the flag thing that happened this year, and without getting into a critique of elite theory and all of that, which I don't subscribe to, I think it's largely nonsense. Nonetheless, it's an interesting thing to see how that was grassroots and how and if even if it was sort of taken over, if it was all a psyop. I don't buy that a lot of things are psyops, certainly not in the first instance. They might get taken over as a form of psyop after the fact. But as Tom said, I agree with Tom again, that it was just lovely to see. I don't care if it became a psyop or something at some point. It was lovely to see. And certainly on some level, it was a grassroots thing. And as for the Russia thing, you tried to... turn the discussion to the Russian thing. I must disagree with Newsfist. Sorry, mate. I must disagree.
That's okay.
I don't think we're going to go to war with Russia at all. I don't think there's the slightest chance of it. For one thing, we're both nuclear-armed powers, nuclear-armed powers.
How would that not be the end of the world? That's always my thought. Yeah. We're going to go to war with a nuclear power. Okay, we're not going to use our nukes? What? That doesn't make any sense.
Think we're going to have a nuclear exchange with Moscow. I really don't.
Right.
I see. When you look at, if you look at the
Russia
Cold War,
have no interest in a war with the
US. I'm fascinated by the Cold War, absolutely fascinated by it. And I've read around it quite a lot, especially in the last few years, the last 5 or 10 years, read much more than I ever used to. And if you look at what was done during the Cold War, you know, Reds Under the Beds, going all the way back to the 50s, but even into the 1970s, even into the 80s, if you look at Threads, have you ever seen that thing, Threads?
Yeah.
It feels like a classic rehash, a really shit, actually, in my opinion, rehash of that, is that you must be scared. The Ruskies might invade us. The Ruskies might nuke us. Don't see.
Just a quick interjection. I remember when Hillary Clinton did her Reno speech in 2016, and she was talking about the Russians, and it was such a weird thing at the time, like this throwback to. And I remember thinking, is this like for her boomer audience? This is what they'll recognize. This is a sort of digestible enemy for them because they did it before.
There's a good episode of Murdoch from that time where there's a scene where they phone Vladimir Putin because they're the alt-right and they're not getting paid. Mm. And they're saying, come on, where's my...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
If I could just respond to Bo quickly. Sorry, perhaps I should have been more clear. I am not saying that there will be a nuclear exchange with Moscow. The war may indeed even be quite limited, you know, the way it is now. The point I was trying to make was that the appearance of a war or a mild war or, program of sabotage or something like that is a very, very useful device for the government to crack down on their political opponents. That was more the point I was trying to get across. Sorry, I should have phrased that better.
No, fair enough. Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's certainly being talked up in the UK media as it's supposed to be a plausible threat. I don't think it in any way is. I think it's one of the most absurd headlines I've seen in a while. And it's almost certainly there to distract from what's really bubbling under, which is, you know, clearly the things have come to a head with respect to reckless immigration policy. This is one of the reasons now why it feels especially, I would say, if you're someone broadly in our camp, putting the arguments for recovering our racial demographics as they were, it's no longer a case of pointing out the window and saying, I think my Windows sound service has just restarted. Sorry if I cut out there. Yeah, it's no longer a case of making dire predictions. It's just basically pointing out the window and saying, look at what's occurred to your country in such a short space of time. So, and the conversation earlier about X, about how real it is and the role it plays, I mean, undoubtedly, it's a very important conduit for a conversation, for a public conversation about what's happening, even if it is not itself the driving force of much of what's happening. I mean, what I think is really happening in a great many cases, at the risk of hogging the mic, I won't be too long, I promise, but people have had several decades to resolve their cognitive dissonance any way they like with respect to confronting racial conflict. And that's the thing about propaganda. It doesn't actually have to be a particularly sophisticated. You just say to just leave people to go off and resolve their cognitive dissonance. They'll come up with all the fantastic explanations they need to make sense of the world. You know, humans just do that. And we don't then like to go back and revisit that trauma of making a choice about our attitudes in the world. And so we will stick with those beliefs up until the absolute limit, their elastic limit. And for a great number of normal people in the UK now, I think that limit's been reached, and they are now revisiting what used to be some sort of safe assumptions and beliefs about race, about the importance of race with respect to national identity. So, yeah, I'd say those things. I see Bo is holding up a very relevant sign. It's an appropriate time to yield the mic, I think.
Is mass deportations actually going to happen? Wouldn't you have to replace the entire managerial elite? Like, I mean, just where are you going to get all of these people? You would have to replace practically everyone at the Home Office, a large chunk of the security services, the civil service generally. Like...
Wouldn't that be like the middle ship in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where there's the three spaceships that transport the people, and there's the useful people in the first and the third one, and then the middle one accidentally gets lost, and
that would actually those are all the managers. Because the kind of people you want to get rid of would probably be exactly the kind of people who would be most panicked about the what was it in Hitchhiker's, the giant space horse that was going to come and eat the planet or something?
Something of that sort.
I mean, I acknowledge the public shift, and I think it's great. And I just, given the plan to sort of ruthlessly gatekeep out of power sort of anyone opposed to this agenda generally, right? Like, so Rupert Lowe is awesome, but there's only one of him, right? If there were 100 Rupert Lowes, if Rupert Lowe was in charge of the second largest party in Britain and had like a whole bunch of Rupert Lowe's behind him and young Rupert Lowe's who are prepared to take civil service jobs and security service jobs, then I would be a lot more optimistic. But I don't see any way that it could actually be changed. Like, who's going to staff the Home Office to stop them bringing the boats in?
Sorry to interrupt you unduly if that's not inappropriate of me.
No,
it may well be that some of these people already exist, but they've previously lacked the confidence to sort of put their head above the parapet. And after someone such as Rupert Lowe takes a confident stand, some of them might then be a little bit inspired and acquire a bit of momentum, perhaps.
I would say, if I can interject there, I would say that there's only one Rupert Lowe at the moment. The future is not yet written. There will be more at the next general election, if polls are to be believed. Reform are going to dominate it, right? So hopefully, probably, the Tory party will stay about the same, maybe lose a few seats, maybe gain a few, but they'll stay dead. The Labour Party will join them, and Reform will be the party of government next time. Now, it's quite a few years in the future, but after that, after Nyege almost inevitably drops the ball and reveals himself to be as much a globalist as any other Lib Dem, then what? Then you'll have many Rupert Lowes at that point. And as for the question of, well, how will it be done? You'd have to clear out the Home Office. Yeah, we'll have to fucking clear out the Home Office. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll have to make a whole new department if needs be. I brought this is from Restore. It's 113 pages. People go, how could it be done? No one's got a plan. There is a plan. It's pretty
I love
thick.
That they're doing that. I love Restore and the guys doing everything they're doing for Restore. I think
shout out to Harrison Pitt. Harrison Pitt over at Restore and other people, Lewis Brackpool, even Josh Firm, loads of Restore and Rupert Lowe are just the very, very, very beginning. It's barely even an opening salvo. Where we'll be in 4 years' time will be very different, and where we'll be in sort of 9 years' time, hopefully we'll have a government with balls to start a whole new department for remigration or mass deportations, whatever you want to say. If you have to clear out the Home Office, we've got to do it.
Ten years is a long time in politics.
One last thing. It's not just like glib. It's not just a cope. It sort of has to happen, because if it doesn't, we end up like Yugoslavia or South Africa, and that is truly an endless nightmare. So it's kind of got to happen, even if it takes 9 years or more. That's my view.
Well, it's a good reply, but I appreciate the depth you put into that. And I don't want to throw shade on any of the people doing awesome work. I've read all the stuff from Restore Britain. I think it's amazing. I'm just very unsure about which way it's going to go. And so I guess I tend to present the negative opinion on it.
What do you mean when you say which way? Well, sorry, man. No, I don't want to cut you off. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. So polite. The English are so polite, aren't they? It's a foreign thing for my Scottish nature. My thing with the Home Office and all these civil servants and all these arseholes, I'm a bit of an AI absolutist. I think, well, just replace them with a mathematical AI who's not going to be politically charged. Just it's a very simple mathematic equation. I don't give a shit. Just have a robot do it. That's what I think now. Yeah, I like Bo was going off there, like go off king, you know. I have to say I am optimistic. Not to turn the conversation too far back, but the flag thing that happened earlier this year, where I live in the Northeast, it happened literally overnight. I walked out of my house and there was flags everywhere. I couldn't believe it. And I thought, who are the people that have gone out and done this? I don't know them personally. I don't know anyone personally who's done this, but clearly there must have been a large effort to do that. And
because they're all feds.
Well, they're all feds, yes, of course. Yeah, it's all fake. And, you know, maybe a few years ago, again, because of the COVID shit, I would have had a more cynical outlook on it, but I genuinely found it inspiring. And I thought, no, this is real, actually.
I will join in with the flag posting, sure. I mean, what's interesting as well has been the regime's response to it, that they made no effort to lean into it and embrace it and say, oh, yes, they're flags of unity. This is my flag, of inclusion.
They did try that.
There was no... Oh, did they? Okay.
They did try that for a bit with the Union Jack to counter the Cross of St. George. Oh, but that didn't work. It didn't. We flopped because then everyone just... Both of the flags, everyone knows what they mean. They both mean us. Right. Yeah, so they gave up on it, I think. But yeah.
Okay, that didn't quite come in under my radar at the time. The part I was going to comment on, though, was what I did see them do, which was the sort of heavy-handed regime tyrannical response of rip them down and send the council out to deal with it, like immediately, as if it's some emergency terrorist action.
Just made them look dreadful and joyless and... Yes, treacherous.
That's right.
So bad. The optics were terrible. Does anyone, and don't be shy, does anyone think on this panel that the flags thing was a psyop, like from the start?
No.
No one. Right. Good, no. Good. Because I don't think it was either. I thought it was unfortunate that some people in our circles immediately sort of defaulted to, oh, this is a psyop, this is fake, this is a trick. I don't even know if it was even co-opted after the fact. I think, and again, the guy who supposedly started it contacted me looking for support because he said, you know, people are talking shit about me and all this. And I understand that he did have some suspicious stuff in his background. He'd worked for some company that was connected to the British security or something. But that was like 5 years ago when he was like 18, something like that. And it was a minor thing. He seemed to be sincere. He knew a person who's a good friend of mine, had known him for many years. And it all, you know, I understood why people sort of jumped to this conclusion based on his LinkedIn profile. But even then, if you were going to be a Fed, why would you have a public LinkedIn profile that says, you know, here's reason not to trust me? It just seems really incompetent. So anyway, the point is... You go. I've said this.
Yeah, I was just going to make a point about the PSYOPs in general, because I'm also very, very interested in the intelligence services and the history of the intelligence services. I've made a little bit of content about it in the past and read quite a few books around it, fictional and non-fictional. There's a great book called Spycatcher by Peter Wright.
That was banned in the 80s for a brief period in the UK, wasn't it?
Yeah, until other countries published it and... they couldn't stop it being published. So that's a very, very, very interesting book all about the real history of MI5 and various other things. But the thing about the intelligence services and PSYOPs is that actually it's quite rare. This is my opinion, and people can disagree with it. But it's actually quite rare when something's a full-blown, like, MKUltra PSYOP from inception. Particularly in Britain, because apart from anything else, their resources are quite small. Now, there are definitely PSYOPs, though, right? I'm not saying it's never the case. There definitely are agent provocateurs. There definitely are intelligence officers that work for or with MI5 or GCHQ or Special Branch or whatever it is. But as for the idea that, like, more or less everything is a PSYOP, no, I think you're passing reality incorrectly if you think that. And just to one last point on that, to fill it out a little bit more colour to it, is that it's a little bit more difficult than that, because you might have, like, an actual intelligence officer, right, someone who works directly for, is employed by MI5, and they've got a handler, and they're told, go out and do this. And be an agent provocateur and feed us back information and infiltrate, da 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 da, on and on and on. There's that. They're actually rare. But then you've got this whole grey area of people that act like that, act in that way, and they're not actually an employee of MI5, right? I think of someone like Matt Goodwin. I don't want to besmirch his name unnecessarily, but somebody like Matt Goodwin, a Matt Goodwin-like figure, who hasn't necessarily got a handler. I don't know if Matt Goodwin has or not. Let's not concentrate on Matt Goodwin. But the point is, someone who isn't a full-blown PSYOP actor, but yet they are still doing subversive things, right? And so it does get murky very, very quickly. But the idea that more or less everything you see is some sort of elite-driven PSYOP, I just don't think that's true. I just don't think that's right. I don't think that's what the world, how the world works.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it is in the nature of PSYOPs that you can't tell. I mean, this is what essentially drives people mad, in my opinion. What's happened is that due to, I guess you could call it the administrative elite, the source of power and the reason for power has become occulted, secreted. No one really can figure out why the government does what the fuck it does. No one really knows what the hell it's trying to do. And so it starts driving people crazy. I mean, say what you want about systems like monarchy or, you know, sort of more robust systems. They may be more tyrannical, but they are at least honest in the sense that, you know, the tyrant will just come out and say, right, we're doing this now, chaps. And, you know, anyone who disagrees, you're going to get the boot. Unlike the current system we have, where everything is slimily and unctuously framed, you know, we're doing it for diversity, we're doing it for everyone to hold the people together, you know, don't let our differences divide us. And I think it's just the constant lying that starts driving people crazy, right? Like being around someone who lies all the time and their actions don't mesh up with their words, and then you know, you go to them and you're like, listen, it's clear that you're like lying all the time, and what you say and what you do are a billion miles apart, but every single time they just double down and say, no, you're the crazy one, I would never lie to you, I'm the government. So I think that's part of why everyone has this tendency to think of everything as a psyop, because I can't figure out how or for why the government is actually run.
So it's safer just to assume that it's a psyop. I mean, just to summarize about the flags thing, the guy whose name escapes me just now, the thing is, loads and loads of people actually have a job history like that, where at some point they've worked for a company that worked for the British government. So it's actually much less suspicious than it at first seems. But the other piece of evidence against him was that, and I thought this was honestly retarded, that this, as I thought this was ridiculous to say that this was evidence that it was, that he was a Fed, was that he'd organized a website that listed all the flag protests where the people were doing this. Well, of course he fucking did. That's so that the general public can know where it's going on and so as to take part in whatever way. It doesn't mean that he's a Fed and he's keeping track. Because, again, if he were doing that, then why would he do it openly? I mean, it's just so stupid for people to assume that that means he's a Fed and this whole thing's a trick. Even though it's having a demonstrably good effect on national morale, it's actually a trick somehow. Really crap. I think certain people, frankly, really dropped the ball on that one. And I think it's a bad tendency for us just to assume that anything good that happens is actually bad somehow. It's like the behavior of a depressed person who manages to poison every good thing that happens.
So I think the UK government probably has to take some blame for that climate of fear and mistrust, though. You know, we've quickly acquired a reputation, yeah. or we, I think we hold a record, don't we, at the moment, for having the most number of people arrested per capita for social media posts. It's sort of 3,000 the previous year, if I'm not wrong. So that's obviously
No. It's 12,000.
Is it now 12,000? Okay. So that's obviously partly going to be driving a sort of general climate of mistrust and fear, I suppose, as much as anything else.
No, but it's also the hypocrisy. Right. Like, again, if the government just came out and said, like, right, we're doing a tyranny now. Right, chaps. OK, we're doing a tyranny now. If you go against this, we're going to like mess you up. That's my point. But at the same time, they are still trying to message like it's 1990 or something like that. You know, we love freedom of expression. We have such liberal values, the rules based international order. And I think it's the hypocrisy that really rankles people more than anything else.
Well, it's just a joke now. Even Trump was joking about it, wasn't he? I mean, that's just become laughable at this stage.
It's incredible. Right. Sorry, Paul. Go on.
The broader point about that, like, everything's a psyop and nearly everyone is like a Fed and all that sort of thing. I mean, it feeds into that thing of elite theory. And what we were talking about earlier, that right near the beginning, I don't think that the powers that be are as powerful as they need you to believe, as powerful as they make out that they are. You know, for example, there's a global shadowy cabal that runs the world. No, there isn't. No, there isn't. Well, Putin isn't in that club, is he? Xi Jinping isn't in that club, right? Like, Beijing doesn't go along with what they say. Right? If there's one just in the UK, Rupert Lowe isn't in it. You know, Britain First isn't in it. Steve Laws isn't in it. Lotus Eaters isn't in it. You know, there's
no one on this panel is in it except for me, obviously.
Yeah, you know, there's PA. There's a number of things, aren't there? The Homeland Party, they didn't get the memo, right? Just because there's number 10.
Well, I'm not sure about
it. And the cab. Well, okay.
Sorry, joke, and joke, the cabinet joke, office joke, joke.
Are an extremely powerful cabal, arguably the most powerful cabal. It's one among many. I think that is one of the things that I came to realize at some point in my 30s, is that there is no single one hand on the tiller. You like to think there is. It's easier to think that there is. But I don't think there is. I think we as a nation and as the whole world, global civilization, there isn't one shadowy cabal that controls everything and we're not even close to that. And even their hand that they have got on the tiller is very, very light touch. They can do a certain amount, but they don't control everything. In, you know, it used to be the case much more. If you look back at Mockingbird or something from the 50s or the 60s, where they could control media to a far greater extent than they can today, it made, that argument made much more sense. But now, no, you've got free agents running around all over the place. If they could shut down Rupert Lowe, they would. If they could just shut down or completely silence someone like Steve Laws, they would. But they can't. The more they try, the more these people pop up.
Yeah, it's too obvious.
I just don't buy the narrative that everything's a psyop and everything's controlled by some shadowy elite.
What you have to keep in mind is...
Iconoclast wanted to say something.
Well, just piggybacking off that, really, this past couple of weeks, I've been abroad. I've been in Europe, seeing some friends, and I've jumped around a bit. I spent some time in Italy, and then I went to Eastern Europe to see people that I know. And during my trip, I met people through other friends, so like friends of friends. And my ears perked up a lot, because a lot of these people, especially in Eastern Europe, wanted to talk to me because they knew I was British. They wanted to talk to me about the state of the UK. And they even referenced the UK meme that's been very prominent this year. Now, these are people in southern Serbia. You know, why would they know about this? Why would they care about this? But in my experience, the last couple of weeks, I've had more conversations about the state of Britain with foreign people than I have with people in my own country. And I just don't understand, you know, it's a weird dynamic that. So everyone else in Europe, generalizing, of course, can look at Britain and say, what the fuck is going on there? And that was basically the question. What the fuck is going on in the UK, Dan? And I'm like, well, look, I don't know. You see it. You see the news. You can make your own conclusions. So, I mean, I have a lot of skepticism about the ability of the state to run an effective PSYOP these days, because it doesn't seem to be very contained.
Tom, what are you thinking? You seem very thoughtful.
Well, I did think that was a good point about, you know, foreign people. I've done some traveling this year as well. I was in Australia, and everyone, I mean, there it feels like Britain before this recent awakening. You know, they've got, and they, obviously the Bondi Beach shooting happened just afterwards, but they were all asking, like, what can we do? How, you know, they're trying to get to the stage that we're at. And it's interesting that Iconoclast mentioned the UK meme that Drukpa Stanley invented. And I was in the chat group that when he was talking about inventing it. And he was like, you know, we need a name to give to this phenomenon. And I can't remember who came up with it. But yeah, it was like the main idea was to come up with a name and to label and package what had been weaponized against us, which is this new Britain, which is the Britain that I saw promoted in the 2012 Olympic ceremony, for example. It's this fake, tacky, not real Britain that nobody really wants. It's sort of grown out of the cool Britannia of New Labour, and it's now become like the ubiquitous product that's sold to us. We're being sold our own country back in a tacky, fake form. But act of genius on his part. I didn't anticipate when they was talking about how powerful it would be and how much influence it had. You know, in mainstream media have started picking up the term. So, you know, the old notion of the alchemists and esotericists, where you must name the demon to destroy it. This is some potency in this context as well. Like, by naming things, by controlling the language, as the left has done for so long, you can completely re-engineer the way people think about an issue. And that, I think, is something I hope that our brothers abroad will pick up on the things that have worked here, and have similar successes. But obviously we can't count a chickens before they've hatched, but it seems that we're moving in the right direction, and part of this is just from little things like that.
See, yeah, that's, so, a, and that's, two really interesting points you made there. That first of all, that controlling the language or influencing the language, creating new terms in order to refer to something that hitherto doesn't have a name or just wasn't recognized, wasn't noticed before. I think that's very interesting because, you know, we talk about, we're all familiar with terms like hate speech and diversity. 30 years ago, nobody knew what that meant because it would have been absurd. Frankly, even the word racism, as we all know, was coined when, I can't remember when, but anyway, the point is our great-great-grandparents or even more recent than that would have had no idea what you were talking about. the very concept would have been foreign to them. So that's an interesting thing that the left has done this and now we can do it. And I would say one example of this, of us doing this, would be UK. Another one would be remigration. You know, the left used to talk about black people reclaiming words, for example, you know, the word I'm referring to. And I think there is actually some truth to this, as explained by Tom. The other interesting point you made was about this current feel-good, well, the 2010s feel-good stuff about multiculturalism actually growing out of Cool Britannia from the 90s. I'd never thought of that before. That's a really interesting idea.
I believe so, because it was an attempt to redefine Britain. With the whole New Labour ticket with Blair coming in was like, it's a fresh start. Things can only get better. We're playing when, you know, and they were, we're going to make and redefine ourselves, not on the old dreary, like remnants of a bygone era of the empire, but on something based on Oasis. And I don't really know what it was actually about, like vibes or something. Like, we didn't we weren't having anything like generating any, like there was no serious idea for what was going to generate.
Vibes and Pringles and hooch.
I think it was an attempt to replicate the success that Australia had with its campaign with Olivia Newton-John, if any of you are old enough to like remember that. Australia did this incredibly successful advertising campaign. I think Cool Britannia was probably modeled on that given the similarities in messaging.
But yeah, basically because it was like a year zero from then, like everything subsequently has been, he set the tone, like, you know, even Cameron and the Tories have basically just been New Labour really since then. We have, in a way, we've only lived under New Labour since then, regardless of whether it's been the Lib Dem Tory coalition or whatever. It's always the same like premises. And they've even only recently, like last year, was it? Or the year before, when they actually enshrined in law that the 1998 Human Rights Convention and the moves of the New Labour government are now illegal to challenge. So like not just, you know, they're already in law, but it's illegal to question the integrity of those laws. Enshrined, because those are fundamentally what Britain is. 1998. It's like that. I really believe that's like a major turning point. Obviously, the rock can go further back if you have a longer view of history. It certainly does. But I think it's important to place it. And I certainly think that specific tacky, you know, version of the UK that Drukpa invented, like is coined this term. It has its roots in that.
I would like to make a point. It's a very interesting point. At least I think it is. When I saw Nick Fuentes utterly demolish Lord Finkelstein, I realized that American political commentary is the way forward with dealing with the British establishment. And that is why throughout my time as a content creator, I always tried to, you know, try to drag more Americans to talk about British issues. I have to confess something as well. I'm not English, I'm Welsh, but there aren't enough Welsh people to make a panel like this. So, you know, since Iconoclast came out as Scottish, I need to come out as Welsh, you know, to be completely open and honest. But when I saw Fuentes, who's only a year older than me, okay, I am 26, I'm not lying about that. I've lived a very rough Welsh life. The only thing that's stylish is my voice. Okay, very rough Welsh life. But when I saw Nick Fuentes going, just laughing at Finkelstein, it's like, me mum died in the holly, I'm thinking, My goodness, where is this level of confidence in the UK? I know why it isn't, because we get arrested for open discourse. I mean, one of the reasons why because I've said plenty of crazy things throughout my time as creator, one of the reasons I haven't been arrested for hate speech is because the majority of my audience is American. Always has been, always will be, and I did that deliberately. Because a lot of people in the UK who do get arrested for, you know, tweets and social media posts, they almost all have one thing in common. They all have a majority British audience. All of them. But if you have a majority foreign audience, the authorities don't touch you. I've said egregious things. I once accused
We don't need to go into examples.
Well, it was quite the controversy. It happened well over a year ago. But I will make the point clear right here, right now. The American discourse, in my view, has gotten them to where they are today. It doesn't matter what you think of the current state of the right in America, which is shoddy to say the least. But they all have pieces of the puzzle. And if they came together and actually worked together, which is why the murder of Charlie Kirk was such a terrifying thing, because he was the man who brought everyone together. And I think that's what we need in the UK. We need essentially a Charlie Kirk-esque figure to be the glue that sticks everyone together. Now, I don't know who that is, but I'd happily try to find them.
I think that... Bo, hold on a second. I'll just say something first. First of all, Kirk, yeah, he did. He had that attitude of bringing people together, but then he's obviously dead. Mm. That leaves a vacuum. I don't know what's going to happen there, but it is a new situation now. Saying things, I don't like the term hate speech, but, you know, it's a real term. Obviously there are some things that you could, that need to be addressed. But I think a lot of stuff, you don't actually need to say, to approach it outrageously. And what's impressed me over the last year and several years is how people are now saying actually quite extreme they're saying things in a very polite way. That 10 years ago on YouTube, I would have said in a more blunt way, and so they're getting away with it. And like they refer to the English ethnicity, for example, instead of saying the white race. And it's not a lie. It's a more precise, it's a more narrow version of the same thing. But nonetheless, I'm just impressed that people have found ways to approach this without coming across like a nutcase or a sperg. Basically, coming across as a reasonable, sane person, because these are reasonable, sane concerns. Bo.
Talking of nutcases and spurgs, I still have something to say on conspiracies and Cool Britannia. I'll hold fire until after Bo, of course.
Okay, thanks.
Well, just a couple of points about like getting arrested for hate speech. I mean, at the Lotus Eaters, we sort of straddle the line, don't we? And on my channel with Nate, the State of Politics, even more so. It's actually, in my opinion, relatively easy not to fall foul of hate speech laws. Just don't be a psycho. Don't be an idiot about it, right? You cannot directly incite violence or racial hatred. If you're careful, it's quite easy not to do that, right? It's like, or accidentally incited racial hatred. No, it's quite easy not to. You can phrase things in other ways, right? So there's that, right? Just don't be stupid. Like we did a segment the other day. Some guy went to prison for like 18 months or something, and I won't say what he said even. But he totally went over the line. Like it's not something I would necessarily think. I wouldn't put anyone in prison for it, but. There's a line. They've put a line in the sand for you. Don't cross that line. Okay. Now that's bullshit, but that's what it is. That's the game we're playing. That's the rules of the game that we're engaged in. Unfortunately, but
I was just going to say. Point, but go on, Tom. Sorry, very quickly, on the, in the same version of white identity, just saying English is an ethnic group, I'm not sure who was the first, but I've been pushing that meme for like years and years and years. I know that more recently, also like a few years ago, Laura Towler was picking up on it and saying it, but I was pushing it for a long time because it was an obvious win. Like, as soon as you specify English as an ethnic group, which is already in some dictionaries as that anyway, then you've got like everything, all the protections for ethnicity that are already enshrined in law. So it was just like, why isn't everyone pushing this all the time? So I've been trying to that was just one example, but I'm glad now that it's just taken off. But it's hard to know who was responsible for that success.
Another thing is, if you're not crazy, like, it's almost like you put yourself in prison, almost. Like, some people, there are like some examples where people basically didn't really do anything wrong. Like, I think of Sam Melia. You mentioned Laura Tower. Think of Sam Melia. He basically didn't, but essentially, in my view, did nothing wrong and still ended up in prison. So there's examples of that. But often it is the way that someone, they did cross the line. It's a bullshit line, but you knew what the line was. So, like,
it's quite easy not to cross it, and you can still see what you want to see. I think that's the point.
Thing is, if you look at Soviet era Russia, not necessarily under Stalin, because that truly was insane, but if you look at sort of 70s, 80s, very, very early 90s era Soviet Russia, people got away with satire. The use of satire was very, very, very powerful. You can couch things in allegory and metaphor and simile and use satire. Mm. And everyone knows what you're talking about, but you didn't cross the line. You didn't cross the line. And so they couldn't put you in a gulag sort of thing. Okay. Mm. Now, unfortunately, that's the situation we're in now, as crazy as and perverse as that is. So there are still ways of doing it. The other quick point I want to make, because it was just brought up, the idea that in America we need like a Charlie Kirk type figure to unite the right or something like that. I think Turning Point and Turning Point UK, the whole thing is containment bullshit anyway. But regardless, I still think that it's a good point. And I've tried, failed dismally, some tiny attempts to unite the right. For example, UKIP and the English Democrats got together a while ago and made like a pact where they wouldn't stand against each other and they'd sort of push together in one direction. I would love to see all the right-wing parties like Britain First, PA, Homeland, Restore, Advance, all those, just try and pull together at least to some extent. It didn't work. They're not interested. Nearly all the parties are not interested in doing that at the moment. And that's the key thing, at the moment. At some point, if there was even Tommy fans, if there was some sort of mechanism, some sort of governing body like FIFA to regulate, to stand above all these parties, all these groups, all these families, and get them to at least not go to war with each other. Just that. Just don't go to war with each other. That would be a beginning. And if you need like a single figure, I mean, maybe it is somebody like Rupert Lowe, but I mean, Rupert Lowe's no spring chicken. I think he's in his late 60s. You know, he's not going to be around forever. We need someone that is going to live for another 40 years, really, to do that. Who that is, no idea. There isn't a front runner. I don't think it's Tommy. We will need somebody, because it's not nice,
yeah.
Is it?
He's even more of a gatekeeper than Tommy, right, in my opinion. Yeah. Acceptable Frog.
Well, taking things in reverse order, in response to what Bo just said there, I thought that was rather interesting. I agree with him that having a law against inciting violence is at least defensible. I also agree that the line with respect to inciting racial hatred is bullshit. I disagree with him that it's still that it's any sort of bright or clear line. I'm afraid I think I would inject a much stronger note of caution there, simply because if you find yourself, say, in my position, I'm rather inspired by Jared Taylor's sort of brand of white advocacy. So I try my best to be civilized and respectful and so on. But even in the process of stating raw statistics, if you say, for example, if all I know about these two men, one of whom is white, one of whom is black, is their race, then statistically one of them is many times more likely to be convicted of a violent crime and statistically less likely to do well in some sort of standardized intelligence test. Now, if I were to say that proudly and confidently without padding that in it, without protecting myself adequately with certain sort of caveats, you know, if I just bluntly spat that out, I can well imagine being arrested in a public environment in the UK for just saying something of that
breach
sort
of the peace or something.
That's right. And then charges of inciting racial hatred could be slapped on. If enough media furore was drummed up about it, if it was in the right sort of, you know, sensitive context. So I'd be very cautious about that. But without laboring that point, with something that's often overlooked with Cool Britannia, with the emergence of Cool Britannia, is around the time where that was happening, that was the zeitgeist, ecstasy was flooding into the club scene, especially in London, and no doubt in many cities across Britain. And that level of drug use of MDMA specifically can't happen without at least the tacit approval of the state, you know. And you think about Robert Putnam's study, Diversity Destroys Trust, the famous Harvard study on the effects of multiracialism. I mean, the chemically induced trust of everyone being on ease at the time when they were flooding the country with racial aliens.
And all of it was produced in Europe, in laboratories in Europe. It wasn't like cocaine being imported by gangs from the third world. This was being produced in the first world, and they could have shut down those laboratories if they'd looked for them hard enough, I'm sure. To back up his point, I've actually heard someone tell me, an ex-skinhead told me that he thinks what killed the skinhead movement in the 90s was ecstasy and the club scene, because everyone was too loved up to care about that stuff anymore.
All right, acceptable. Frog's dropped out again. All right, Ryan, it looks like you're wanted to say something.
No, I was just going to say the acceptable frog was being so on point that they got rid of him, but he's back now.
Right. There we go. Thank
you. Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I got kicked. My Windows sound services periodically crash. I'm awfully sorry about that. I have to reinstall Windows or something. But for some reason, StreamYard boots me when that happens, it looks like. I do apologize for the technical problems I'm giving Woz. He doesn't need that headache. Thank you for your patience with me. But yes, you know, considering the Putnam study flooding the country with MDMA at a time where racial aliens were being, you know, forced up on us for the first time in our history, that seems like rather a coincidence, doesn't it? Looking back, it may be worth looking into how those things could be related. And the final point on a grand cabal and conspiracies. Over the last year or so, I've done a few streams with the alternative hypothesis with Ryan Falk. He's looked at in some detail into all flavors of these. And one of the things that comes up again and again is convergence is a very common phenomenon. So just encountering a lot of people who suddenly will report they've all seen the same thing and experienced the same thing without any actual conspiring happening, that does happen. There are all these people that will swear they saw the mad gasser of some city at some time in history, where there's no evidence whatsoever of it. Yuri Bezmenov gets referenced far too often in our circles, but just forgive me, I'll commit the sin of bringing him up one last time. Something that will ever stick in my mind, him pointing out his famous interview after he defected from the Soviet Union, is that in order to change people's minds, you don't have to have a kind of propaganda that makes them believe a thing you want them to believe. All you do is you just tell them this is what people believe, and most people will just then go along with that. And because we've had this media control in a relatively centralized group of hands for so many decades, it's been enough to sort of tell people this is what it is, this is the normal opinion on race. And with respect to X, the freedom that people have today to express whatever they think about race and politics on X from the UK and around the world, we have to be ever so careful, because in many, many cases, what they're going to do with that freedom is just simply regurgitate those decades of saturated propaganda and programming that they've been sitting in. And we're going to think, oh, wonderful, now there's this free exchange of ideas. You know, remember that legacy is going to take a long time for the public conversation to weed out, I would say.
I think it's a really good point that people say you can't meme something into reality. If you just say it enough, it doesn't make it true. Well, in some senses, it does. No, it really does. I wrote an article a long time ago, well, 3 or 4 years ago for Lotusetus called Remigration is Inevitable. And in that, it's a take on where the UN said migration is inevitable. So the take on it is remigration is inevitable. Yeah. And at the time, that was sort of kind of fringe. No one was not. I wasn't the first person ever to say that. But now it's sort of common parlance almost. A lot. I see lots of people saying it. And yet, if you sort of, it sounds like a pie in the sky nonsense. But if you sort of do say something enough, believe it enough, regurgitate it enough, it becomes a zeitgeist. It becomes part of the narrative, if you like. That is a real phenomenon. In the article, I wrote about how Tony Blair used it. I mean, it's been used since time immemorial, but Tony Blair was a great one for using it. He would just say something like things. A couple of examples spring to mind was when about the Millennium Dome. He was just like, no, no, it's happening. We're making this happen. It's going to happen. Get on board. Or when they did a massive cull because of all the cull of the cows because of mad cow's disease. It was just like, no, get on board. It's happening. Or some European project, some part of the European project, the Maastricht Treaty or something. Just get on board. It's happening. It's going to happen. And it sort of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. One other quick point I'll make, just while I've got the...
I'll just say I agree with you. I found your article. It was from 2022, and that really was ahead of the curve. And I agree with you. If you actually just insist on things, and I saw Steve Laws doing this as well, it does take on a life of its own. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. Sorry, go on.
Well, one other point I was going to say is that somebody brought up the idea of that you just, yeah, if you just, well, there's not so many examples of it now. I mean, Academic Agent, didn't he say zero seats? He came up with zero seats, didn't he? Then they put him on, somehow he got on with Jacob Rees-Mogg on GB News saying it. Remarkable. You know, if you just say things enough and it catches people's imagination enough, if it's sort of a real statement, if you like, if whatever that means, you know, it's a real statement that resonates with people, put it that way, something that actually resonates with people. I kind of despise doomerism and defeatism. That it is nothing that can be done. It can't be changed. Don't try. No, fuck that. As hard as possible. Forget that. That's slave talk. Get off your knees. Right?
I think one of the good things about repeating that mantra of remigration is eventually then the other side has to come up with a response, right, and tell you why it's a bad thing, why it shouldn't be done, why it can't be done. The onus is then on them. And as the demographic situation changes, it becomes increasingly, you know, a pressing thing that it's impossible to ignore.
And one last point I'd like to make is about this idea of you've got to be like much more caution. We must be cautious. You must be very careful. Don't say this or that because you'll end up in prison. Well, again, if history is anything to go by, we need men that are not afraid of that.
Oh, yes.
We need men that aren't afraid to show their real face and their real name and stand up and say something that's a little bit beyond the pale.
Can I ask you a question, though?
Who's the Gulag Archipelago guy? Solzhenitsyn, right? Do you know what springs to mind? I recently reread Hitch 22 by Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, yes.
Right, and Christopher Hitchens was a full-blown lefty as a young man, right? And in that book, he talks about how they're proud to go to prison. They're in court all the time. They're in court all the time, and they still turn up at places they're not allowed to go to, and that they're proud to be in the dock.
But Bo, okay, would you leave a little bit more of that?
I don't want to be responsible for anyone that ends up in prison, but you need to push the envelope. If we're afraid all the time, it's not good enough. Stop being afraid a little bit.
Would you just let me please come back to you ever so quickly on that?
Of course.
I mean, one of the reasons I brought up what I did earlier is exactly that. Yes, we need to be confident, certainly not to be afraid. The only thing is, when young men do take that risk, and I share your view that they ought to, they need to be aware that they are taking a risk. And what I'm very worried about is saying to people, look, there is a bright line. We might not agree with it, but at least you know that you're not stepping over it. I would be very cautious about that because you can. So the better attitude to have is to say, yes, I might step over it, and then so be it. I'm going to take that risk. It's better to go into it knowing the risk. I would only say that.
Antifa get the kid gloves in court. We don't get that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to wish you a good Yule and duck out now. I'm not sure how long it was going to go on for, but thank you both for that excellent white pilling, inspirational the little exhortation there, because death to the black pill, no dooming. And,
all right.
Thanks. Good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Thank you.
Nice to have talked to you, Tom. Thank have you. A pleasant evening.
Okay. Thank you.
He's a great guy. Can we just kiss Tom's ass a little bit here? What a great guy he is, genuinely. Yeah. What sterling work he's done over years.
For a long time. Leader. I mean, he's eight years. That's 2006, is 8 years earlier than I started. I didn't know he'd went back that far on YouTube. It's amazing. But Bo, since you mentioned the Zero Seats campaign, I think it's perhaps worth playing this video to remind everyone of the joyousness of that campaign.
So you bought it for Nigel, you bought it before. You've had enough and now you want to see them perform. Let's go to have you thought about this concept before. The Tories get zero seats. So do me a favour, when cometh the day, and the ballot box is battered up, it's taken away. And you put a vote for Labour in the box and you pray. And the Tories get zero seats.
Very good. I thought that was great. It was Chris Gard who did that. I guess that was, what, a year and a half ago now? But I think it's a classic. All right. Is there anything else to pick up on from what we've said? Has anyone else who's been itching to say something, but they've had to hold back because they were cut off by someone else? Anyone?
Sure. One thing I've also noticed in the UK political landscape is that it's not just the right that want their grievances heard, it's also the left. You look at the Greens at the moment, how well they're doing recently. I showed the polling figures to my father, who's 70 years old, has always considered the Greens to be a joke in politics. And yeah, 17-18% in polling. He could not believe it. A party that has barely ever changed in decades is now, in the running. I know it's a five-horse race, folks, because that's the British political landscape, but he could not believe it. And it's an example that it's not just the right wing of British politics that are sick and tired of the way things are. It's also the left wing of British politics. I mean, Keir Starmer is Timu Tony Blair, and he is failing on every front. This thing with the Egyptian magic spell name that's impossible for me to pronounce is a living, breathing example of this catastrophic administration.
I mean, indeed, what you're basically seeing is the rise of political polarization. And this has a number of sort of significant knock-on effects for a really long time, since probably the end of World War II. It has been assumed among the political class that the way to power is to appeal to the center, right? So if you sort of think of the electorate as a distribution graph, you have like a big hump in the center where most people are sort of broadly moderate and and so the way to get it to get into power is you capture that center. As things move to sort of more of a saddle shape, right, and the center declines, all of the sort of political formulas or paths to power that have been assumed since that time begin to break down, because it no longer becomes a given that by capturing the center you can win. And so you're going to get this rise of where, and I think we're seeing this with the Conservatives and with Reform and with Labor, that they can't do it without the, you know, what they would call the extremist party, right? So if you think about it, the Greens are just an extreme form of Labor. Restore Britain is just, you know, the Conservative Party, but with actual principles. They would, you know, I mean, if you define extremism as actually wanting to do things with government as opposed to just, you know, sort of sitting on your ass, and it's gonna be very, very interesting, because it's becoming increasingly harder. I think mass immigration is contributing to this significantly, to find a political formula that can actually encompass everyone, right? Like, so the latest thing is, you know, my British values, okay? So that is an attempt at a political formula, a legitimacy play that can cover as broad a base as possible. But it's not really working. There's too much gulf between ethnicities and different polities to make one political formula that's actually going to work for everyone. So then instead you wind up in a sort of oscillation mode, which is, I guess, what you've seen in America, right? Where one side gets in, they do a bunch of stuff, and the other side gets in, they reverse all of the stuff, and it wobbles back and forward. And this is a very, very unstable configuration. So I don't know how you could get to a point. I think remigration would be a great way to get back to the point where you have a big hump in the center, because I think a lot of these political formulas are based on things like ethnicity and language, because a lot of political speech doesn't really, it hits you below the conscious level of awareness, right? These are words that are loaded with many, many different connections, you know, like diversity or, you know, whatever. And so they need sort of like a common language frame in order to be effective, right? If someone just steps off the boat and you said to them, you know, my British values, what are they going to think, right? Like, they don't even speak English. It's not going to make sense. So I don't know where it's going to go from here. That's kind of my like basic analysis at the moment. I really don't know how it's going to turn out.
One thing I would say is I'm not interested in the centre ground anymore.
No, me neither.
I'm not interested in the centre. Yeah, it's, people bewail, oh, there's no more centre ground anymore, and the increasing polarisation of politics. Yeah, that's what's happened. That's what's going to happen. When you look back at history, that's what always happens, nearly always happens. When the left go berserk and try and steal everything, try and steal the state, and then there's a reaction to it. Yeah, the centre loses. How often throughout just the 20th century we see communist scrawl on the wall that liberals get the bullet too. Yeah, I'm not interested in the centre ground anymore. No, I'm interested in nationalism. I'm interested in the right. I want the rise and success of the right. Fuck the centre ground. Oh, I'm a centrist dad. Fuck, get real. Come on. No, it's too late. It's too late for that. It's too late for that. We're into a spiral where there will be the polarization both left and right. Then you see that in the rise of the Greens, for example, a perfect example of it. Yeah. And I'm not here for the right. I'm not interested in drawing it back to the center. I'm not interested in the center. I don't want it to be drawn back to the center. The center loses for us.
I think one reason that the center has become an impossible place to occupy and almost a non-existent ground is that the assertions of the left are so frequently just outright wrong and false that the answer to that is to say, well, no, that's just not true, that's wrong. And now you've got the true camp and the false camp, and there is obviously no center there. There used to be a range of positions which were all to some degree rational or reasonable or could be defended, and you made your selection and you argued. And, well, you know, now someone who would have been a centrist in 1948 would be considered far right today. the views on race and national identity that our grandparents held when they fought against the Nazis were much closer to those of the Nazis than they are to the modern left in the UK or anywhere else. This is an uncomfortable fact.
We've done the centre. We've played that game. We tried that, and it got us replaced in our own ancestral homeland and millions of girls raped.
That's right.
That's what the centre did.
Well, that was extremism masquerading as the centre, being passed off to us as something reasonable. What it in fact was just, you know, our complete disinheritance and basically invasion. I mean, it's not over-egging it now. I went back and checked those statistics, by the way. Yes, up until 1994, 97% of births in the UK to new babies were to, you know, white British couples. And now the next year will be the first year that drops to 49%. So new white babies will be a minority of births in Britain from next year. If that isn't an invasion, I don't know what is.
Yeah, and if that doesn't get people animated, what the hell is it going to take? Categorically see, we are now less than half of the births in this country. I mean, people can split hairs and pretend not to know what you mean by we and all this, but ultimately they're just kidding themselves. They're just slowing down a natural and very necessary conversation. And some people will do that. They'll have the slyness and stupidity to do that. But I think most people know the implications of that, and it's not pretty. It's not going to be pleasant for them or their kids or their grandkids.
I was just going to say, this is why I'm such a big fan of the Green Party and what they're doing at the minute. If it was up to me, I would put Zach Polanski's stupid, goofy face on every fucking billboard in the country at this point with his retarded quotes. I mean, on Christmas Day, he shared a message about accepting refugees, and I just thought, this guy's a gift. I mean, forget about the centre. Bo's right. The centre's gone. I mean, you want to promote this guy as much as possible, because when people like him and his party exists, we're only going to get stronger. And I think that's only a benefit to us.
I'm very glad you spoke up there, actually, Iconoclast, because, yeah, you actually make this, you're a good case in point. I was just about to say, we have to avoid repeating the mistake that we made with Islam and the conversation around Islam, I would say, that the reason we had child rape gangs operating with what's close to impunity for decades is that the conversation around Islam was paralyzed, mainly out of a fear of accusations of racism and a willful confusion between religious identity and racial identity. But the conversation lagged behind the problem 20 or 30 years. With race, I think one of the reasons that, you know, this the Guardian went after you and you were the victim of, you know, these nasty hit pieces, is that I remember when I was writing for your magazine, actually, Iconoclast magazine, and I was still at that time very focused on Islam. And I remember we had a conversation once, and you were expressing politely expressing some degree of frustration about, oh, bloody Islam, you know, that we're also looking at, for example, the effects of Africanization in London and so on. Mm-hmm. And you were ahead of the curve, or at least you were catching up faster than other people with the conversation about race. And we have to get ahead of it now. We have to overtake it. We have to be entirely fearless and say, look, race very clearly is a biological reality. It's not a social construct. Any evidence you could ever want for that is now available and accumulating. If people remain afraid to have a racial identity in the UK, they won't remain as a population, as a group. We will die.
Well, interesting point. I remember being on Millennium Yule actually in 2018 and chatting to Woz, and it could have been 2017. I think it was 2018. And Colin, you said, "I've said everything I can say about Islam now. That's not really my concern." And that's, you know, not that it isn't a problem in Britain and the Western world in general. Of course it is. But I mean, I always use my parents as a good measuring stick of this type of thing. So my parents, they're in the mid-60s. They're both boomers, right? And a few years ago, 10 years ago, when Trump was running for president for the first time, my mother hated him. She thought he was just crass. She didn't like his personality, all this stuff. She thought he was, she thought he was too far ahead, too extreme, whatever. Now, I reckon if I bought her a MAGA hat for Christmas, she would wear it proudly. And that's, you know, that's kind of the change that she's gone through. But there's one thing that she and my dad, to an extent, will never, a line they'll never cross. And that is the kind of, what you're saying, Frog, the racial identity thing. Mm. And more specifically, the Israel thing and the Jewish thing.
Oh.
That's, you know, that's about as far as they go. And someone like Tommy Robinson, who 10 years ago was toxic to the mainstream, they both watch him on YouTube all the time. I mean, they think he's great. And I don't know if they're going to get beyond that, but that's just, that's the level of acceleration that they've gone through themselves. But, you know, not to be cruel, but the boomers are dying off, literally. And once they're gone, I don't think these roadblocks will be in place anymore. And it's going to be a very exciting time.
A bit of a white pill there. I think on our side, the JQ seems to have become less of a contentious issue than it was a few years ago, but partly because of the American exposure with, you know, Fuentes pushing anti-Zionism as a increasingly mainstream talking point, and at least Israel's over-representation, if not Jews' over-representation in the States, is now pretty much a normie talking point. So what used to divide us...
incredible, actually.
I mean, it is, isn't it, in such a sense? Yeah. And what used to divide us, at least, well, now on the racial right, there are a spectrum of views exist on the JQ and even on World War II revisionism. I mean, Jared Taylor, for example, is rather famous for being ruthless on race, absolutely, you know, but has people frequently, I think quite unfairly, have criticized him for not commenting further on the JQ. And he has just left that to other people to do, mainly. He just doesn't really talk about Jews in the main. But I've noticed that people who would in the past have been diametrically opposed to, for example, Jared Taylor, some unity has emerged. I've seen supportive tweets from Jared Taylor for Joel Davis, not because Jared Taylor has a single Nazi bone in his body. I don't think he does. But I think he recognizes that, well, here's a group of young men who are doing white advocacy in Australia. They are putting the case for the native population of Australia, white Australians, and no one else is. So some sort of unity emerges from that. And I've seen that come out of our side in the last year or so. And that's very encouraging. That's not dividing us now in the way it has, I think, for years.
You know, I think that everyone can see that there's a certain group that immediately opposes white identity, even if you haven't attacked them or criticized them. They swoop in immediately. And I think that's just become impossible for many people to ignore.
So what Frog just said there is absolutely true. And that's where the conversation is heading. The wind is only blown in one direction. That's just the way it is. The people who instantly come out and try and stop you getting there, it's so obvious when they do it. I mean, God, I swore that I wouldn't mention him, but Constantine Kissin, for example. I mean, that crowd, they're always the first to respond whenever the conversation is drifting in a way that they don't like. They're the first line of defense, and they get deployed by the powers that be, whoever they are, and they're there to stop you from going that extra mile. And I was saying to my mother on Saturday when I saw her, when I got back from my trip, and she, it's funny because she watched the Nick Fuentes Piers Morgan thing. Now, she's no fan of Piers Morgan by any means. I don't think anyone's a fan of Piers Morgan, but she detests Fuentes. And I said to her, look, give it 18 months, you'll be his biggest fan. Guarantee it. Because that's kind of the pattern that everything, that's the pattern that everything's falling into. People who are unpalatable to begin with suddenly become fine just a short time later. And that, I've witnessed this myself with various other figures. And people like Kissin and bloody Douglas Murray and all the rest of them. They get left behind.
Andrew Gold.
And,
yeah.
Fucking hell.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, no, he seems like a nice guy, but I do think he's... It's like your tweet was, oh, they just pretend not to understand anything. And I look at his face and he's just like, what do you mean by that? What are you talking about? and honestly, but they will be left behind because they've either got to get with the program or become irrelevant. And if they do get with the program, some of them can't do it because of their own identities. But those who do will clearly be grifting, and you can see the fraudulence in their actions. So I think this year in general has been a great litmus test for that type of thing. And
absolutely. And Ben Shapiro is just a shadow of the man that he was a year ago. But I would, I mean, really fucked this year. But I would say similar about Konstantin Kyssen. And in fact, he's only been saved from the fact that he's been less prominent than Ben Shapiro. But if he'd been more prominent, he'd be equally fucked.
It's been a terrible, terrible year for the Zionists. I mean, this is the thing. If the blank slate sort of narrative breaks down completely, there are very severe downstream consequences of that for this certain group. Because, you know, arguably they were sort of the first to promote this idea, you know, that, you know, race doesn't exist, everyone's really the same. And what we're sort of living with is the downstream consequence of that. And I think the other narrative that is increasingly going to define the next few years is, how did mass immigration come about? What were the reasons behind it? And who was responsible? You will notice that nobody in government ever talks about this. So, for example, Dominic Cummings said that...
They have a narrative for that, which is that
we
invited them over. Because there were gaps in the labour market, which is complete bollocks. But I don't even think that kind of stuff will work with the public. Those kinds of arguments will work with the public now. I think they can see that today we don't need these people. Today, we don't need more Somalian asylum seekers, refugees, and so on.
More than
the just history of it is probably less interesting to the general public.
I think
they got him again.
Maybe I'll quickly jump in there. Very interesting. Some people even say that there's no such thing as the Overton window, that's an unhelpful thing that doesn't exist. I think it is an interesting and helpful term, and it sort of does exist. Whether you want to call it something else, just like, you know, the narrative sort of momentum, whatever. Yeah, we've seen a massive change on sort of the Zionist Israeli Jewish thing. I mean, I did a segment on Lotus Eaters about the Tucker versus Shapiro war that's going on, war of words, that's going on in Turning Point UK, or just in the American theatre. Even we saw recently, didn't we, that the USS Liberty incident is now okay to talk about, whereas before it was taboo. And when Tucker had on that, what was his name, the revisionist historian?
Daryl Cooper,
yeah, yeah. The question of how many years have to pass, how many generations have to go by until white nations are allowed an identity of their own, despite the German experiment of the 1930s and 40s, right?
Well, never, is the answer to that. Never.
Because, you know, it's like Britain, France, Germany, the United States, Australia. You can't have a country because Goebbels existed, right? Because Himmler existed, you cannot have an identity or a country. Right, that narrative cannot last forever. It can't.
It's one that only really works with the boomers.
The window shifting faster and faster and faster. If anything,
quite. Sorry for being interrupted by technical problems again. To come back to what Woz was saying, not more than simply that we don't need these people, but that we cannot have these people. For a very long time, the racial egalitarian narrative basically relied on everything being explained away in terms of individuals. So, and that could be made to fly for the longest time. I've lived in horrible parts of London, which are mainly black areas, which were nasty in the 90s. But I look, every single violent, unpleasant black individual that I encountered, I would explain it away to myself as, oh, it's that poor deprived area, or it's that group, or it's that section. And in my mind somewhere there's a group of black people in sort of, you know, formal smoking gowns in a library somewhere, say, oh yes, Marjorie, do pass me a copy of the African Times, please, very good. But you know, over time I came to realize that these were mythical blacks, but the individual varies, okay, but the group is always the group. And we now have a large enough group of racial aliens of various sorts in the UK that the group average is now impossible to ignore and impossible to lie about.
And are you seriously saying that you've never encountered blacks like, oh, damn, it's not working. Oh, that would have been really funny. That would have been so funny if it
I worked. Trust it would have been hilarious, Rose, whatever it was.
Oh, just imagine that you saw it and it was very amusing indeed. Hold on a promise. Minute. Sorry, go on with the point.
Well, yeah, so only that. The group averages, you know, with the best will in the world have become impossible to fail to notice. And so people who would previously have gone along with the tabula rasa model of human nature have had that absolutely tested to the limit, as I alluded to earlier. And they're now having to revisit what used to be comfortable beliefs about race. Jewish identity used to be something that could exist as an ethnic identity in addition to a religious identity. And in the UK, we were happy to sort of give that to Jews because, well, they're special and the Bible mentions them and they've got their religious identity that's got this heavy Venn diagram crossover. So, okay. And we've got our identity, which of course is cultural, and we have our quotes British values. Now, that was always nonsense. Obviously, culture doesn't magically drop out of the sky, as Jared Taylor has said many times. people make a culture. And we're finally having to confront that British culture is as it is because it was made by British people. And that had it have been produced by Africans, it would have looked radically different. And that's no longer something we can talk out of existence with.
You know, it's amazing, but you can even sense this, like when you're in the company of a bunch of Indians, for example. Even if they grew up here and they're born here, it's still not it's not the same feeling. It's not the same tenor. The conversation is different. You know, it always was,
and we were always polite and nice about it, and that doesn't work anymore.
One thing I think, you know, words are very, very powerful. The exact way you express yourself is important. I think the term an in-group preference. I think that's quite a useful term, and that some people might just call that racism, that's bigotry to have an in-group preference. And yet, as
Trump
was saying, you cannot deny that other peoples express a very, very strong in-group preference for their own group. And once again, the question is, how many years have to pass before we, the natives, the whites, whatever you want to say, our group, our in-group, before we're allowed to have an in-group preference openly, strongly, it's in the mail, it's in the post, it's coming. It cannot be denied.
It has been very interesting watching Connor argue with Danny Finkelstein about exactly this. Why is ethno-nationalism acceptable for Israel, but it is not acceptable for the UK? And the answer seems to be, never fully stated, of course, but the answer seems to be, well, you are an economic zone, shorn of race, shorn of identity, you know, because World War II, because, you know, the definition has now bled out to encompass every single white country, even those that fought the mustache man. I mean, if that isn't the greatest kick in the teeth, right? You literally go to war to stop the mustache man, and then 80 years later, you are responsible for the things that he did. Shut your mouth. I think more people are cottoning on to the fact that this whole culture is built upon special exemptions and
moral blackmail,
differences in morals. And that this continual assertion that, oh, you know, we live under isonomia, right? The laws affect everyone the same. Everybody's the same, right? You're just an individual is just untenable as a political formula. It's collapsing. And I'm totally here for it because it hasn't been true, even remotely true, for a long time. And I think it's the hypocrisy that riles people up more than anything else.
Yeah. Okay, I'll now put up that meme that I was going to put up earlier when it would have been timely. So can you all laugh heartily at this hilarious meme? Here we go.
Thomas, I am a bit concerned about this recent stock market fiasco. Do not be alarmed, William. I have handled our investments accordingly. Splendid!
There we go. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed it. All right, we'll get to some super chats because there have been a few. The thin red line said at the start, a very strong banquet team. England lives. Thank you very much. And I agree, this has been a good mix. All right. Ardent Party, I won't read that one out live. I think you can understand why. And then the thin red line said, I think there is a limit to how tyrannical the system can become. Every regime needs a raison d'etre. In North Korea, it's communism and anti-colonialism, and no one expects that you can say whatever you want. In the West, the raison d'etre is democracy, open society, and free speech. And although you can bend and stretch that, there are limits. COVID already stretched it too far, and that plays a part in the skepticism towards the system among normies. Would anyone like to comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And this is something that's been occupying my mind increasingly, which is, will they back off when the sort of inconsistencies become apparent, or will they switch to a much harder, more forceful use of power, which will make governing increasingly more difficult? I don't have a question. I feel like it could go either way.
On that, I would say the current government, Keir Starmer, I honestly don't think they've got the bollocks, right, to go full Stalin, to go full Mao, to send men round to your house in the middle of the night and you disappear, like 1950s Stalinist Russia. I don't think they've got the stones to do that. I don't think they've got the prison space to do it. So I don't see that happening. I might be wrong.
It's interesting, though, you mentioned the prison space there. It's very interesting you mentioned the prison space. Do you remember earlier we were talking about propaganda? There was a very conspicuous, I thought, government statement put out by the media from the official government X site at the time, and various other places, and various police forces as well, after the Southport riots, within a statement to the effect that, and I'm sorry, I won't get it word for word, but something along the lines that, you know, we're very concerned about the prospect of, it didn't say protests, it said riots, you know, or even it may have said terrorist XYZ, following the Southport riots. And we've made sure that there are an additional 500 spaces available in prisons in the UK ready for XYZ. Now, this was after three little girls had been butchered by this second generation Rwandan immigrant. And the numbers just struck me there. It's 500. That's not very many. That's like not a lot. You'd think thousands of people might be out on the streets and at risk of arrest for that kind of activity. And I realized the reason the number was so low is just this projection into the mind of the British public that if you go out and riot or protest, even God help you, then, you know, you're the exception. You're that tiny little extreme, yep, unrepresentative minority handful of people who may be arrested, but everyone else is expected to just behave. And I realized that's just ham-fisted. I thought, come on, let's see that for what it is, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point. It is, at the end, a numbers game. And once the numbers grow too large, there's just not the capacity. I was thinking about the only possibility that might reverse this is if they go full digital public infrastructure. And rather than imprisoning people, they just start excluding them. But again, like, how many people can they conceivably do that with? What, 5% of the population? 10% of the population? There are hard limits on how many people they can exclude in this way. And I think maybe this is one of the reasons why, as you were saying, Acceptable Frog, they always frame it as, you know, this small vociferous minority, because I don't think they can conceptually cope with the idea that a significant proportion of the population will fundamentally just sort of turn on them, basically.
No, and with respect to how they manage the public response on X, this is something else you brought something back to mind. Although the algorithm can and clearly does attenuate voices and amplify voices out sort of seemingly on a whim, what it can't do so effectively is hide ratios, hide replies, because, well, okay, an individual X user can hide replies to a tweet, but then he or she will quickly acquire a reputation for someone who does that and who hides from responses. But when it comes to, you know, for example, Peter Hitchens, you know, legacy journalist, well-paid man, you know, household name pretty much, been on national television plenty of times. I had, I think, sort of 900 followers, 1,000 followers or something on X when I ratioed him. Specifically, he was encouraging people to look into the possibility of Axel having high THC content in his blood, you know, trying to blame the massacres on marijuana. And I said, Peter, do you blame the Rwandan genocide on marijuana? And that, my reply to him, massively ratioed Peter Hitchens. And I realized, well, okay, apparently X, you know, is a some sort of viable platform for a public conversation. Elon isn't a totally a snake oil salesman here. I'm a guy in his bedroom in Eastern Europe ratioing Peter Hitchens. So, you know, okay, I'm going to keep going with this, you know, bit of a white pill.
Yeah, it's always nice to ratio P Hitch.
Not so hard, but
I did myself earlier. I mean, that's the great thing about Twitter is that if you're right, if you're just clearly in the right, you'll usually get the ratio. Usually, mm-hmm. I remember myself. I haven't got a giant Twitter account, but even when it was a lot smaller, even when I was only a few thousand. Like getting in someone's replies. I remember the first time it happened to me, or among the first times, I ratioed Jacob Rees-Mogg on something or other. I just said, you're a traitor and I'm glad you lost your seat, or you're going to lose your seat, or whatever it was. And he's got like 400,000 odd. And I ratioed him. And it's like, oh, right, yeah, well, because I was just saying the honest, real truth. I was making a statement of truth. And so, yeah, thank you, Elon, for allowing that to happen, you know. It really was a game changer.
It's good, isn't it? The weak link in the chain, though, I think, is when the rubber hits the road, and I'm going to use the Australians as an example, because they were quite recently comprehensively wiped off X, the NSN guys. Now, the reason that happened wasn't actually because they contravened any of X's terms of service, and arguably, nor did they contravene the laws of their land, but all it effectively takes is someone to whisper the T word to the X, you know, team, terrorism, some national security agency has to make the phone call, and then, you know, you're gone. So far, it seems as though X is sort of broadly willing to just comply with that. Now, in the UK, if you're someone who wants to organize for your demographic group, for your race, let's just call it what it is, you're going to very quickly come under the radar of our security services. And it's not going to be terribly hard to at least get yourself, you know, designated a prohibited organization, at which point they can lean on X and have your voice silenced. And it's worth mentioning Laura Towler and Mark Collette and Patriotic Alternative, who are still all conspicuously absent from X. Serena Brown pointed that out today. So that may be worth, you know, just keeping in mind, I think.
Unless you're Egyptian, right? If you're Egyptian, yes, you can campaign for the dismantling of the Egyptian regime and incite all sorts of nonsense. That's why the whole situation with that magic spell name guy whose name, my goodness, what a name. I can't even pronounce it. But you can do that in Egypt and probably be bought and paid for by the British government, which is why he's being sent here, for undermining his home country. But if you do what the same guy did as a British citizen, you're crossing more than a red line there. You're crossing into very dangerous territory.
And we have quite a precedent of this. Sorry, Ryan, I don't want to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
No, just so we have quite a precedent of this. I mean, at a time where our Home Secretary was prohibiting Jared Taylor, mild-mannered, never broken a law in his life, Jared Taylor, from entering the UK, we were permitting Islamic preachers to lecture who were explicitly banned from preaching in Pakistan because they were considered to be too radical. But they're, you know, we have them in, we had them at least in mosques in London. So that double standard, yeah, it's an ongoing problem.
I'm just having a blank, folks. I'm trying to refocus, so give me a minute.
No, that's my fault. Ryan, I jumped in there, so take the blame for that. I hope someone else has a thought bubbling over, though, perhaps.
Well, I was just going to say that you mentioned Peter Hitchens there, and I forgot he existed, because I'm sure many of you were in the same boat as me. When I was a teenager, I thought Christopher Hitchens was by far the cooler brother.
Hmm.
You know, the whole new atheism bollocks, and you know, he says it like it is, and he's a very charismatic guy. Peter Hitchens, he had a moment, I guess, 15 years ago, where everyone was like, you know what, I got this guy wrong. Peter is actually the better brother. And I should have, it was just my naive, youthful nature that thought that Christopher was better. that picture says it all. Yeah. And
this is from about 5 years ago, but I don't think it's far off, actually.
But that says it all. The problem with Peter Hitchens is he's just so fucking depressing, and he never says anything of value anymore. It's always just like, oh, just give up, don't try, move away. If you're young enough, then get out while you can. Was he smoking dope? Like, that's all it is now.
Oh, it's yeah, so his confirmation fucking, bias with weed is just...
Yeah,
he's got, like, Trump derangement syndrome with weed.
Yeah, look at these memes. Incredible, incredible. And look, I'm not a weed smoker at all. I've never had it. But, again, it's just so ridiculous. Is this the best that we have? And he's a household name. It's just... Come on, bro. Get it together. Yeah.
I know marijuana is more important than heritable biological human traits is just rather absurd, but it's his thing. Yeah,
I wrote another article called "The Boomer Doomers," and I never explicitly referenced Peter Hitchens, but it's basically about Peter Hitchens or people like him anyway, and they're not all boomers. Shout out to the based boomers. There are some based boomers; they do exist. And there's among some of the more hardline as well. But no, the doomers, of which Peter Hitchens is their king, they need to be stepped over. They absolutely need to be stepped over. In times of real war in the past, I'm thinking of World War II, maybe the Napoleonic era, being a doomer was not allowed, simply not allowed. You cannot do that. You have to be on board with the struggle. So I think that our first enemy are the doomers and the defeatists and even accelerationists. Now, they need to be stepped over. We haven't even begun to fight yet. And you want to give in. You want to spread your defeatism. No. That needs to be defeated first and foremost, if anything. The idea that you would advocate for particularly the younger generation to flee, to abandon their ancestral homeland. I can't think of anything more disgusting than that, to be perfectly honest.
I'm very glad Christopher Hitchens came up in this conversation, actually. He's one of those people, sort of a little bit like Charlie Kirk in a way, that it's one of the tragedies of him dying is that you're now deprived of the chance to sort of see where would he be now if he were alive. Because Charlie Kirk looked as though he was on a trajectory which would have been extremely interesting and I think valuable for him to have had the chance to fully pursue. And likewise with Hitchens, although he had a relatively, you know, long and fruitful career compared to Charlie Kirk, Hitchens for the longest time was pretty terrible on race, let's be honest. To be fair, he was amazing on Islam. And he didn't shy away from literally going to war zones. He would put himself in situations whereby he saw the boots on the ground. But with respect to race, I think he was victim of what so many literary people fall victim to. He managed to and inevitably found himself surrounded by very capable people, creative people, responsible people, productive people. And he's going to experience the top 1% of any racial group, you know, through his circles. And that's, of course, going to distort his view of other groups, of other racial groups. If he had done the equivalent of going to a war zone, but he'd gone to the Bronx or he'd gone to some very black neighborhood in the States for 2 weeks, I think he may have, indeed, he may have found himself sort of updating some of his racial egalitarian views.
But didn't he say in some debate, but what if the bell curve is true? I'm sure that there was some moment where he almost did it, or he was flirting, he was thinking of it, and then it was one of those, you know, with the four atheists, which, doesn't that seem like a different age now?
Yes, that was 2007, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. That was Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens,
And Sam Harris.
And Sam Harris.
Yeah.
He was one of the people who conspicuously did not pile on Douglas Murray after the bell curve and so on. He was one of the people who would never come out and join in the stomping on Douglas Murray. He was very good in that respect. Same with David Irving. Well, he in fact defended David Irving rather famously.
Don't you mean Charles Murray? You mean Charles?
Sorry,
Murray.
Charles Murray. Did I say Douglas Murray? Forgive me. Oh, yeah. Silly.
Yeah, I was going to say, is Douglas Murray secretly based? Well, you
know, I do forgive me.
It's funny. Does anyone remember this moment? I remember seeing an interview with Douglas Murray and who's the Canadian guy? Clear up your room.
Oh, Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, Jordan Peterson and Douglas Murray were sitting down together. And the bell curve came up, or the question of IQ, racial IQ came up. And they both decided to just not talk about it and move on to something else. Yes. How telling is that?
Well, look, the intellectual dark web. Yeah, the intellectual dark web. We're quite consistent on that. You'll notice that Sam Harris is exactly the same. It wasn't as though he ever disputed any of the claims. He was always, his default position was always, but why should we even pay attention to that data? What moral framework could even exist whereby we can act upon that responsibly?
This just makes me so fucking angry. I feel enraged hearing this.
I would suggest possibly that Harris's ethnicity had something to do with that. Because lurking behind the bell curve
but not Douglas Murray or Jordan. Yeah, sure. We all know that, but not Douglas Murray or Jordan Peters, right? No. Or Christopher Hitchens a quarter, but yeah. I think this is something, again, what do they all have in common? They're neocons. It's really interesting how this...
And they're wealthy neocons.
...coming up, you know?
Going to say, you know, I brought Christopher Hitchens up there, and, you know, he died early from cancer. I think he was 61 or something. So relatively young age to die. Yeah, but he died as a neocon. I mean, he was very pro the Iraq War, for example.
Yes.
And
I've just been told that Christopher Hitchens was a Fabian. I didn't know that.
Well, there's elements of Christopher Hitchens' personality where you think, is he just taking this position to be contrarian because he did have that within his personality? But I do think
Letters to a Young Contrarian, actually, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I do think that he was a genuine neocon. I mean, in the 90s, he was very much a classical liberal or whatever you want to call him, almost a leftist. But then for some reason in the early 2000s, he became all on board with the Iraq War. And then from then, you know, his criticism of religion became more prominent. And people say, well, what would it be like now? And I just think you have to look at where Douglas Murray is now. And I think it wouldn't be too dissimilar to that. Now, I think Christopher Hitchens, for all of his faults, had way more integrity than Douglas Murray has.
Oh, yes.
But again, would he be our guy? No, I very much doubt it.
Well, although iconoclast, I don't think we can rule that out either. We'd have to wait till this to see where Christopher Hitchens would be now. I remember year on year he would regularly do this appearance on, was it Tim Robinson, I think, a US on C-SPAN, and every year he would be faced with the same question: are you still a socialist?
Was it Peter Robbins?
Oh, well done, Woz. It was. Yes, it was, right, for sure. Okay. And every year he would say, are you still a socialist? And eventually one year Hitchens had to just go, and he didn't answer the questions as quickly as he previously had, and you knew the different answer was coming. So if he'd carried on along that path, just because he's no longer with us, I want to leave open the possibility he may have got there, you know?
Well, three of the biggest what-ifs are Christopher Hitchens, Andrew Breitbart, and Charlie Kirk, if you want to look at it from that perspective. In regards to the bell curve, I have a very simple answer to the issue, right? You look at America, you look at Liberia. Right. Compare the two countries, exactly the same constitutions, polar opposites in terms of who is running things. The United States, very flawed place, but still the great power on earth. Liberia, they're eating each other. America is not an idea, folks. Neither is Britain. Neither is Liberia.
Neither is Haiti.
Neither is Haiti. People make nations. That's why whenever I hear people say, oh, well, he was born in the United Kingdom, the soil doesn't give birth to a person. Annoyed me. Another thing, because I'm starting to remember what I had forgotten earlier, it takes about 80 years for a people to recover from their guilt. Right? It takes about that long. And then it usually takes about 30, 40 years for the effects of that to really manifest. You look at you know, from the fall of Napoleon, 80 years, the Napoleonic era was at its peak at the end of the 19th century. And then 30-odd years later, we had the First World War. That's a great example of it. And we're going through a similar experience now. The 80 years are up. The boomer generation, my father is a boomer. I love him to death. I know he's going to die soon, right? And that's going to be the case with most boomers. And then the entire present system will collapse because it's run by people who are, quite frankly, dinosaurs. That's why I love it when American political commentators engage with British media figures or British political figures, because it is a sight to see. That's why I bring up Fuentes and Lord Finkelstein, because it's like the 20th century is fighting the 21st century in the discourse. And maybe that's why Piers Morgan used Finkelstein as a human shield to protect him from the disastrous interview he had with Fuentes. I hate Piers Morgan, especially, you know, I always bring this up. The only reason he has a profile in America is because he fled British prosecution over hacking a dead girl's phone. That's the only reason he went to the United States, was to avoid prosecution. Americans only know him because of the scandalous things he did in the UK. And that's always irked me. And not a lot of Americans know that. So everywhere I go, whenever Piers Morgan is brought up, I always remind folks of that. So
now, come on, you're doing him a disservice. He was a judge on America's Got Talent.
Let's we need
to give him praise where it's due. Piers Morgan is a fascinating character. I think he's scum. And I don't think anyone's actually a genuine fan of him. I don't think he has an ideological bone in his entire body. He goes where the wind is blowing. If he woke up tomorrow and it was the popular view to be a white nationalist and you could get paid for doing it, he would don that cap straight
away. Oh, undoubtedly.
He has no fucking... he's got no skin in the game, really. He's got his money. He's there to just facilitate his own ego. He's a grotesque narcissist, and that's all he is. But then again, I mean, the Fuentes interview was, it did illuminate the shocking differences between the generations. And I think it was overall a very positive thing for us.
I think Ryan's summary of it being the 20th century arguing with the 21st is a really good way to look at it. And we're just really waiting, and I don't want to sound cruel, but we're waiting for them, you know, to get out of the way so that things can really progress. Yeah. All right. Anyone else want to chip in here? No? Okay. I'll move on to the next super chat. And these were from a disembodied voice. And this is earlier on when we were talking about the flags thing. And he said, "You all seem convinced that psyops are not common. Please bear in mind the UK is the country that invented SIS in World War One and has an unlimited budget to do this stuff." What does SIS stand for? I don't know what that... Does anyone know?
Secret Intelligence Service.
Yeah, you'll notice that's the new name for the MI6 on their website. Yeah,
the Secret Intelligence Service. Okay. I think I've got to say, they've got an unlimited budget for these things. What? Sorry, that's nonsense, I'm afraid.
Well, okay, in practice, it's rather hard to even know what restraints are being placed because of how much is redacted and because of, you know, it's, well, you fill in the gaps. Yeah. Perhaps not unlimited, but certainly a healthy budget.
Let's just put it this way, guys. If the British authorities were effective, why do prisoners get accidentally released? Right? This is a phenomenon that happens in the Starmer administration. This guy was accidentally released, and then again, and then again, and again, and again, and again, again.
Yeah. And some people were suggesting that that was deliberate. But then that brings us to this new guy who's just been allowed into the country over the last few days, whose name, unsurprisingly, I can't remember. And again, some people were saying that's deliberate. It's a deliberate insult. But now, apparently, the Home Office are investigating him to... and also the counter-terrorism police are investigating him for these tweets. But the Home Office are investigating whether he should have been allowed back at all based on these tweets. So they're looking into whether this was a... I don't know if this is genuine or not, but it would seem to suggest that this wasn't deliberate and that they now feel that they've they've screwed up. Now, that doesn't mean that they'll actually correct the error or that anyone will get fired for it. But why are they even doing this if the whole point was to insult us in the first place? Why are they now saying that we're investigating it? Again, I can understand the police doing that because that's going to lead to nothing. We all know he's not going to get charged with tweets from 10 years ago. But the Home Office, that I don't know, that implies to me that this was a genuine screw-up.
The purpose of a system is what it does, isn't it? At the end of the day, it almost doesn't matter whether, for example, this guy is released deliberately or as part of some sinister sort of psyop. Because, you know, Sam Francis, an old, I'm sure you know, you're very familiar with him, I expect, Woz, an old acquaintance of Jaron Taylor, I think coined the term anarcho-tyranny. I believe that was his term. Forgive me if I'm wrong about that. But but yeah, you don't essentially need this sophisticated plan to oppress people. It's enough to dump chaos on them. And whether the guy's released because of filling the prison service and the judiciary and the police with incompetent people, or whether it's a deliberate ploy, the fact is there are these racial aliens running around the country who shouldn't be at liberty. But fundamentally, they shouldn't even be in the country in the first place, whether they're in prison or not. That's a little bit of a red herring in a way, I suppose.
Yeah, especially if they just get released into the public at the end of the prison sentence anyway. And during the prison sentence, we have to finance them. I mean, it's almost a double insult.
And probably the least important and least brought up element that has only just passed through my head. Why should even the white prison population be exposed to these people in prison? I mean, prisoners have some rights too, right?
I think our prisoners absolutely should have the right not to be exposed to foreign criminals. I mean, I think it's just dereliction of duty on the part of the British state.
Well, there was a very dangerous theory I heard from some American commentators in regards to that, because from an outsider's perspective looking in, they're of the view that the people who get arrested and charged and convicted of, you know, hate speech laws and that sort of thing, mean tweets, that sort of thing, they get sent into the prison population, but they get sent into a specific part of the prison population where they get murdered, in a sense. And that's the dangerous theory that's coming out of the United States, that there is a system in place in the UK. And it really terrified them, because if Camel Toe had won, the Americans could have gotten arrested and shipped over to British prisons for violating British laws. That was a literal party position of the Democrats, to have these hate speech laws essentially imported over. So that's why they saw it that way. In regards to the Egyptian guy, you look at his record, the man's a terrorist. The man incited violence. First it was peaceful protests, but then it turned into violent protests against the Egyptian government during the Arab Spring and the years afterwards. If he was a British citizen doing that in the United Kingdom, he would never leave prison, considering his rebellious activities. I honestly think, you know, dangerous conspiracy theory, folks, I honestly think he was a bought and paid for British agent, and then they're bringing him home to shut him up, essentially, so that he doesn't expose the fact that he was bought and paid for by the British or the West to incite or help incite another Arab Spring revolution in Egypt, which has a military government and is one of the more stable Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he was big in the Arab Spring. And it was fine when, he was fomenting unrest against a government that the West, broadly speaking, had a problem with. The other possibility is it's been a long-standing thing with the British to offer people sort of escape from their milieu if they do something for them. And if they stop doing this, if they don't sort of keep their promises, then people will stop working with them. This apparently the thing with this guy has been going on for 15 years. He's basically like the Egyptian Litvinenko, if you know what I mean, right? He's like the Western cause celebre that they can use to pressure the Egyptian government and stuff. I don't know. It might just be that up until this point, they figured that they could essentially dump as many foreign political dissidents inside the UK as they needed to get whatever thing that they wanted to accomplish. But now that the tide has shifted and it's becoming increasingly untenable to do that.
I mean, it's a big problem. I know this was far earlier in our conversation, but in regards to a conflict with the Russians, it's like, no, we've got to deal with Venezuela first and Iran. I mean, the West couldn't even occupy Iraq and Afghanistan. It's got no chance against Venezuela and Iran, and even less of a chance of occupying Russia, even under the crazy scenario that the Russians never used their nuclear weapons. Oh, they would. And they got a lot of them, right? We should be putting our own people first, be more isolationist, get our own house in order before we fix other people's houses or blow them up in the West's case, okay? Let's fix our own houses and then conquer the world.
The West doesn't really fight wars for territory, though. So, you know, the special operations model is more you go in, you blow up the government, you collapse the economy, you install a new government, and you never really take territory. I mean, like Iraq would be an excellent example of this. It's not like the US did what the Russians are doing in Ukraine and sort of slowly conquered the entirety of Iraq. That was never the goal. So it seems like, for instance, that's what they're trying to do with Venezuela. If they're going to do it, it's not that they're going to occupy the totality of Venezuela with military force. They'll do that old chestnut. They'll collapse the government, collapse the economy, a bit of drone strike here and there, and essentially sort of exist in a sort of permanent state of counterinsurgency.
So another Libya or Syria or Iraq or the countless other...
Yes, no, exactly. Because taking actual territory is a pain in the ass. And it's not really the territory that they want, it seems. It's more the resources that flow through government. It's a very, very weird kind of like way of waging warfare.
I mean, the 2003 liberation of Iraq was very unpopular, but even then it made more sense in that context because racial egalitarian. Oh, sorry, is my level too high there, Ryan? Should I be? Oh, okay. It made sense because if you're a racial egalitarian and you're a neocon, you know, you believe that, first of all, the multiracial project is working in your own Western country. Well, first of all, and you believe that the reason why it's working is because you uniquely possess these wonderful Western democratic values, which are making this all work. And if you believe that, well, then it makes sense to want to export those around the world and gift those to Iraq and to wherever. Obviously, today that's much less tenable because it's flatly untenable because clearly the multicultural, multiracial project is abjectly failed right across Europe and is demonstrably, it's easy to put an argument that it's failing in the States as well. And so this impulse to export this disastrous system has disappeared along with the faith in the system, at least for a lot of people.
There is
he's gone. Where's he gone?
Bruce himself has disappeared.
Oh my gosh.
I would say, are any of you guys aware of a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman?
Yes, of course.
By John Perkins. That's a very, very interesting book. I did a bit of content on that with Dan Tubb. And it's exactly what you say, is that they try and put pressure on you from, first of all, the State Department. Then if that doesn't work, they'll try some shenanigans with the CIA, maybe even assassinate your leader. And if that doesn't work, will they start sending in aircraft carriers and Marines. And the idea that Britain... had the first secret intelligence service in from World War One. I mean, the idea of an intelligence service goes back to the ancient world. In medieval times, there were all sorts of intelligence officers running around all over what today we would call an intelligence officer running around. So it's not new. It didn't start in World War One with the British. I mentioned the book Spycatcher. In that, Peter Wright talks about that in London, in the 60s and 70s still, during the Cold War, London was awash with Soviet agents. It really was awash. There was a few places in the world. Vienna was famously one of them. But London was one of them where a lot of espionage and counter-espionage took place in London. And the budgets we had then were tiny. They were tiny. We were completely swamped. We were up against it. They didn't have enough men, literally did not have enough men to watch everyone they wanted to watch, not even close. Now, we live in a different world now where, you know, much more is done electronically. You don't necessarily need a human spy watching, sitting outside an apartment to see if a Russian KGB agent has left the building or not. But nonetheless, the idea that we can, that we've got an unlimited budget. I mean, that's just not the case. I don't know, there is the
question of non-state actors though now as well, right? The rise of global NGOs and other sort of non-governmental or quasi-governmental groups has clouded the picture somewhat. I mean, Spycatcher was written in, was it the 50s? Or, I mean, the period that it is covering is a long, long time ago. I don't think you need to automatically assume that everyone running influence operations is a state actor. Like, quite the opposite.
Yeah, no, fair point. Good point. No, Spycatcher is old. I mean, he wrote it in the 80s or the 90s, and he's talking about his career, which was in the 50s, 60s and 70s, yeah. He retired of old age in the 70s, yeah. We live in a different world now, absolutely. Yeah. But the point is, I mean, I can't deny that. I'm not trying to deny that. But the idea, just the idea that, like, the intelligence services are, like, again, this, like, all-powerful, all-encompassing, all-knowing, all-seeing thing. I just honestly don't think it's the case.
Well, speaking of the Cold War mindset, I know not a lot of people realize this in this day and age, especially in the 1970s. Most Western strategists were of the view that victory over the Soviet Union would have been impossible. That's why detente in the 70s was really pushed, because why fight a hopeless battle when you can come to an agreement, split the world in two, and carry on until the end of days? Now, that shifted completely in the 1980s. And how did it shift? Because of one political force in one country saying, no, we are not making peace with this evil empire, right? So-called, but it most likely was. And we're going to do everything we can to destroy it. And within a decade, it was completely destroyed, okay? So zeitgeist shifts are very important. There's a reason I focus a lot on the United States, because if a zeitgeist shift can happen there, the consequences internationally would be unbelievable. Incredibly unbelievable. If America really embraced America first as a mindset, the game would completely shift. And a lot of the problems we face would disappear in a few years. Because, let's face it, a lot of European countries are heavily dependent on the United States. And if that support was annihilated under an America first, America only system, then the authorities in our respective countries all across the European continent would be far, far weaker. And you look at NATO, look at defense spending. If the United States is like, nah, don't want to put any money to this, Russia would be a heck of a lot stronger, just because all the funding to the Europeans would be a lot weaker. And you could say the same of the Ukrainians. I mean, without Western funding, Ukraine would fold like a pack of wet cardboard against the Russians. So that's why I focus a lot on the U.S. and U.S. Commentary, and that's why I try my best to... I'm deplatformed now, so my influence is very limited, but try my best to encourage, you know, more American people to talk about European topics, especially British topics, because British and Americans do have a lot in common.
Yeah, when you have to remember, of course, the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold.
Yes.
You have to remember that for generations we were programmed to receive an invasion before the invasion physically took place. So parents who loved their children inculcated their children with certain ideas and beliefs about national identity and racial identity and so on, which were just flatly false and ultimately destructive. But at that time, they weren't presented with the reality of the harm. At that time, that was a psychological effect and phenomenon and we had the smiling Chris Akabusi on children's television, and the presenters, and the happy black children on TV. That was what was presenting our brains. Today, there's obviously a big lag between that fantasy propelling people forwards and them having to meet the reality of massive, sudden mass immigration and demographic change and upheaval. And the rubber meets the road, and there's a clear conflict there. But there's this lag of at least a decade or so, maybe two or three, of people losing that. And it's not as though you need this constant sophisticated government operation or MI6 or the SAS or whoever pulling strings in the background. You just let, you know, society tick along. People will keep propagating their same cherished beliefs right up until they become fully unsustainable. You know, they will aid the system free of charge.
And I make the same narrative argument when it comes to Israel. Without the support of the United States, let's face it, how long would Israel truly survive with most of its neighbors being hostile to it? I mean, we talk about, say, Iran being so hostile to Israel, but Qatar have done more to undermine Israel in a year than Iran has in how long? How long has that nation existed? Nearly 50 years now? Because they saw all the countries that opposed Israel violently, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, Libya, all those countries just get completely crushed one way or another, either diplomatically or just outright destroyed. And that's why when folks like Mark Levin say, oh, Tucker Carlson, they know. They know, because folks like Levin are being played by other folks who are playing them better. And that's why I think it's very important for people to realize we do live in a multipolar world. And I think the undermining of the existing system is living proof of that. There is the Chinese sphere, the Russian sphere, the Indian sphere, the European sphere, the American sphere. And they're all clashing, all of them.
All right. Bo has to leave. So, Bo, before you go, do you want to... say good night and any hopeful, positive last words for 2026.
Yeah, sure. First of all, thanks for having me on. As always, I'm very much hoping for an invite next year. It's been fun. It's good to speak to Tom and all the guys on the Iconocast and Newsfist, Acceptable Frog, and Ryan. Great to see you guys. Great to speak to you. Yeah, anyone who hasn't already, do subscribe to what? Lotus Eaters, The State of Politics, History Bro. Look out for my morning show starting in January. And as for positives, I think just onwards and upwards, I really do think the defeatist mindset is one of the biggest hurdles at the moment. Just the mindset, the idea of just giving up, surrendering, not even trying. Abandon that. Abandon that. Live up to the promise of our forefathers. We're not descended from fearful men. Don't be afraid. Keep fighting. We've just barely begun. All right, with that. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
See you, Bo.
Cheers, guys.
See you, Bo. Nice to chat with you. Have a good one.
Cheers. Bye.
I do think he's gone now, but I was going to say to him that the idea of doing a morning show is a good idea. I think a few years ago when I was considering getting back in the game, so to speak, I was thinking, what can I do? And the idea of doing a morning show, a live stream, like, I mean morning, as in 6 in the morning until 9, like a proper...
Morning like, with Dan.
Morning with, yes.
Morning with Dan and Nick.
Who's Nick?
Like Anne and Nick.
Oh, right.
Fuck it out. That's obscure. Look, I mean, I think, it's a good idea because no, I don't think anyone's doing that. Like, be a proper morning show. And that's people can drive to work and listen to your racist rants. It's a good idea.
It's traditional, I believe, to have a female co-host, though, for such shows. Would you be entered?
We don't do that here, my friend.
I see. No further questions.
I'd rather do a morning show than spend every Saturday for 2.5 years being on a show from 1 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the morning. Looking back on it, that was torturous, but there was a reason I did do that because I got to meet a lot of prominent people in the pop culture circles. And I actually met Millennial Woes, not through any political discourse, but because of the fact that a gay black doctor, along with a female, completely ruined Doctor Who, okay? Right? This is a great irony. Every time me and Woes talk, I want to talk to him about politics, and he wants to talk to me about pop culture.
Well, you know, it's the thing that you and I have in common. You know, most people don't care about that, about Doctor Who, and especially this new stuff. So I don't get to rant and moan about it very often. I was looking for. Oh, here's a photo of what, just so that people know exactly what we're referring to here.
Oh my!
There you
God.
Go. Okay, that's for kids. So all right.
Hey. By the way, we almost got through 3 hours without Doctor Who coming up,
and that's, it wasn't my fault when it happened. Just let's everyone remember that.
By the way, Woes, I saw Woes ranting about Alien Earth in a previous stream, and I haven't seen it, but I don't need to. I know exactly what you're like. You got really wound up about that, didn't you?
It's actually worse, much worse than I was expecting. I was staggered by the many different ways in which it is bad. But anyway, if you've already got me riled up, I mustn't get into it again.
I must point out, though, right, throughout my time as a content creator, going through, you know, topics related to popular culture, those topics, the bread being moldy and the circuses being crap, has been a great open door for new generations of people to enter this arena. The pop culture to political pipeline does exist, folks. And I do credit that for bolstering our collective rants. Because the more you do this, the more you are a content creator, the more years you do this, one of two things happen. Either you become more cynical or jaded, or you become more radical. Sometimes it's a bit of both. And I think what I do, now I do it behind the scenes through the network. I help another creator basically finish what I start, is a great way of bringing more people into the arena so they can go through the pipeline. And in a few years, we'll be having a pack of Fuentesians. That's what I call Nick Fuentes. I call him a Fuentesian. I have no problem with the guy, except for the fact that he looks like a femboy fascist. That's the only problem. It's the same problem I had with Ben Shapiro. It's like, I'm not going to listen to anything you say because you look and sound like a 12-year-old.
I will respect him a lot more when he comes out as gay, honestly.
Sorry.
Oh, dear.
Yes, there we are. I'll put my heart on the sleeve.
All right. A disembodied voice also said the flags may have been organic, but what prompted them? Axel Rudacabana. Rudabacana. Well, whatever. Who was he? He was known to the security services and police. They created him. As for the flag thing, Zionists were getting sick of seeing Gaza flags. I enjoyed the protests, as long as we benefit. I take the point, but I don't think the reason the flags thing happened was that Zionists were sick of seeing Gaza flags. I think they tried to make it that. I remember seeing a few tweets about that, but it was weak. I don't believe for a second that most of the majority of the people who took part in that were thinking, ha, it's good to see the England flag instead of the Palestinian flag in my town at last. No way. Yeah, absolutely. That was a far more visceral thing for English people than the fucking Palestine.
And the weird sort of coincidence of it, assuming this is a coincidence, that apparently Starmer was working as a lawyer at the time where Axel Rudabacana Banana's parents applied to come in from Rwanda. And apparently he didn't personally sign off on their visa, but that's been attributed to, well, technically someone in his office did it, but you know, that's like the person who signs the documents for him kind of thing. Have this, you know, a population that's from a place that's basically famous for a machete genocide, and then their offspring end up hacking little girls to death with a machete. I mean, it's like you couldn't really write it more perfectly, could you, to make the point?
Yeah, Absolutely. I mean, that is why you shouldn't be letting people from that country in at all. Because, I mean, I'm not saying that they've got a genetic predisposition to that kind of thing.
Oh, I am.
But they've got some predisposition. all right. Okay.
Well, what we can uncontroversially say, I suppose, effortlessly agree on is that heritable human traits are real and they do make an operational difference to how people behave in the real world. And they're not equally distributed between racial groups.
We have living, breathing examples, same ideas, different people. The USA and Liberia, Rhodesia and Zimbabwe.
Indeed.
South Africa, 1980s versus 2000s. South Africa.
Yeah. I put this meme examples. Up earlier. Yeah, I put this meme up earlier. I'll see if I can find it. It's perfect. It's one of those ones that really just sums everything up at once. And no, I can't find it.
I would like to, again, just reference my earlier point about how the UK government historically has allowed people to move to the UK in return for some service for diplomatic or intelligence functions. In my opinion, that's probably the most likely reason why Rudy Cabana's father was allowed to come over. And they just don't really seem to care once they're here.
Yeah, that's very possible. I mean, this whole thing this year with the Afghan asylum, who supposedly helped us, our government, our army in Afghanistan. And so that means we've got to help them all. And we can't help them by giving them money. We can't help them by getting them placed in some other country. We have to bring them here. We have to give them access to our women and our children. That's the only way we could possibly repay their fucking kindness.
No. It's great leverage. If you're living in a terrible place and the English come up and they say, you know, do this thing for us or work with us, and in return, we will airlift you out of this war zone and you can go and live in England. That is a very, very powerful incentive, right? Beyond money, beyond threats. It's, you know, it's a very, very powerful incentive.
Yeah, well, I take that point, yeah.
Yeah, I'd just like to also make the point, never trust a collaborator. Because if they can betray their own people, of course they're going to betray you. In every single respect, the only good use out of a collaborator is that they're a means to an end, and once the end is achieved, they suffer the same fate as the ones who resisted. By collaborating, you're just buying yourself some time. That's all you do. We shouldn't be giving refuge to people who collaborated with us because, as I said earlier, if they can betray their own people, they will betray us quite clearly.
Oh, and we know it's a lie of political convenience because there are plenty of documented cases of people who really did help the British Army as translators and so on, who were denied access to the UK, who denied visas rather conspicuously when we pulled out, who were murdered by the Taliban subsequently. So when they need a reason to add more people to the UK, it will be summoned from whatever's vaguely plausible is the takeaway, I think.
And they kept it secret as well. They didn't want it to be public knowledge. They tried to keep it under wraps, which tells you everything.
Yeah, they knew damn well how the public would react. But what was even more ridiculous was that it wasn't just the collaborators, it was also their relatives. And I think each one was entitled to bring up to 20. I can't believe I'm saying that. Is that... Hold on a minute. Let me just make sure.
That does sound right.
Very powerful incentive.
I don't know 20 people in my entire life, never mind family. Like, Jesus Christ, it's insane.
Right, I think it was... relatives. They brought an average of eight each, but that's the average. I think the maximum might have been... I'm sure it was either 12 or 20, but that sounds so incredible. That
no, that's quite believable.
What you're talking about is airlifting an entire tribe out of there. And this would make sense because a lot of the politics in that part of the world is tribal based. So if you want a tribe to work with you, you say, well, we'll airlift you all out of Somalia or Afghanistan or whatever and send you to England where you can,
It's so nonsensical. I mean, help us to improve your country and we'll remove you from your country. It's just ridiculous. The whole thing is nonsense.
It is nonsense, yeah. And that is why, folks, I am of the mindset of we consider Afghanistan to be a terrorist state. As far as I'm aware, the Taliban have maintained law and order within their sovereign emirate. And if they don't want their girls to have an education, if they want to literally have an Islamic empire, it's their country. It should be up to them to decide that. Last thing I think any of us want is foreign collaborators in our shores, because they will betray us, because betrayal is in their blood in that sense.
They've demonstrated it. Hmm. Yeah, I agree. All right, we'll move on to another super chat, although it feels like we could talk about this for ages. Right, ABC said, for educational purposes, how did the Christian country of Shakespeare, Newton, and Darwin get to now jailing people for silent prayer while broadcasting Muslim calls to prayer? In terms of motivation, parties involved, and time frame, what could the end goal be for the elites? Fucking hell, that's a very...
We got there because their loud, noisy religion is a proxy for their race, and we're not allowed to say anything bad about that. Therefore, we have to put up with tannoys at the top of bell towers blaring out Islamic Arabic calls to prayer at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
I would just say Google Andrew Joyce Empire Windrush, and you'll find an essay that will probably put you on the right track to understanding how all of this began.
I have an answer. I call it the alien versus predator effect, folks. You've got one who will stab you in the front. I won't mention these particular groups, but you've got one that will stab you in the front and the other that will stab you in the back. Whoever wins, you lose. And the only way to actually win against them is to deal with the one stabbing you in the front first. I know this sounds very weird, but bear with me. Deal with the one who stabs you in the front first, because it's an active invasion, then deal with the one stabbing you in the back, which is an occupation. That's why you stop the invasion, end the occupation to rebuild our sovereign nation. And we're getting there, folks, but it's going to take a heck of a lot of willpower and effort. And the best blueprint I can see, sorry to bring it up again, is the United States. They will deal. I think they will ultimately deal with their Somali problem. And I think it will come to a point where, after the boomers die off, they will deal with their AI pack problem. Haha, I said AI instead of its actual one. And then all we have to do as Brits and Europeans is copy what the Americans do. And if we actually did that right now, we would be way more effective. Just copy what America does.
Good answer.
Sorry to say that.
I like that.
British people aren't big fans of Americans and vice versa, but there you go.
I was just worried because you brought up Alien again, and I thought Colin was going to crash out.
No.
I mean, it might not be transparently, obviously, a racial issue, but it is. And the test of that is, imagine if most Muslims were white and there was this white country called Muslimistan full of white Muslims. If they came over to Britain in the same sort of numbers and behaved in the same way as brown Muslims do and have done, they would have been called out from day one and hated and chased out the country. But because we'd been programmed to be so accommodating to racial aliens, and they happen to, of course, have a different religion, we were terrified of that. If you're not sure about that, look at how Polish people are treated and talked about in the UK. People hold no punches. People are absolutely, white British people are unafraid to say horrible things about the Poles because the Poles are white. So they know that they're immune to this accusation of racism. I think it was a racial issue.
I know this was a long time ago, but do bear with me. The Islamic occupation of Spain, or Iberia, to use a better term, folks, this was before Portugal was a thing, or even Spain. Most of that Iberian population collaborated and became Muslim during the initial invasion, and it took 700 years, and an alliance of the French and the Iberian peoples who didn't defect to essentially push Islam out of Iberia, which is now Spain and Portugal. The vast majority of the Muslims they pushed out were Iberians, which is today Spanish, Portuguese, in a sense, olive Europeans, right? So not not full-blooded northwestern European whites, okay? I see it as a religious issue, mainly because of the fact that Islam is very effective. They are very principled people in that they haven't changed in 1400 years. When they started, Christianity was way stricter than Islam when it first started out. But Christianity has changed and evolved and, in all honesty, diluted itself. Whereas Islam, they don't change for anyone. You want to change Islam, you got to fight it and beat it, or it fights and beats you. If the Christian world had that sensibility and kept that sensibility, Islam would not have escaped Arabia, never mind the Middle East as a whole.
I mean, Ryan, I absolutely agree with you. Don't let me be misunderstood here. Yes, it certainly is a religious issue. The fact that there's a racial element which has hamstrung our response to the religious threat doesn't mean the religious threat is not religious in character. And you make an excellent point that it has this baked in unchangeable, unyielding quality that it says in Arabic, this is the final unalterable word of God in the Quran and must be only read and understood in the original language. It has that baked in quality. I think it's because it's been foisted on us in this context of a vacuum of an absolute prohibition against having a genetic biological identity. And in that climate, that strong triumphalist expansionist religious identity has, of course, bulldozed in. You know, we haven't been able to oppose it. We've paralyzed.
I can agree with that sentiment. There is an admirable quality to Islam, despite the fact that most Muslim beliefs are, quite frankly, sick, not in the positive sense, in the negative sense. One of the great qualities of Islam is their principle in not changing. That is something that I can really support as a mindset of, because, you know, principle can be a good thing, but it can also be a bad thing if they have some. And that's the key point here, right? If Christianity, if the Western world had the same cultural values as it did 1400 years ago, the Islamic world would not exist. Let's face it, folks. North Africa, the Middle East, wouldn't have been conquered by the Muslims, because North Africa was a white continent. It was a European subcontinent. Same with Anatolia and the Turkish and Middle Eastern regions. Islam, literally, its base is in Arabia, Mecca and Medina. We just need to consider the fact that as a group, they will not yield. And I can admire that, but I can also oppose that, because I know an Islamic world will essentially be exactly the same thing until the end of time, because that is what they believe, that is what they will stand by, and quite frankly, it will not be a pretty sight, okay? Especially when they try to take on the Chinese are systematically wiping out their Muslims. Not a single protest, because the Islamic world know China could destroy them if they put their mind to it. Because the Islamic world doesn't have a unifying force. The last great unifying force was the Ottoman Empire, and it got ripped apart. And that's why Turkey exists today as quite frankly, a Western puppet. But if Islam did have a uniting force, and they did for a few years, it was called ISIS. What happened? What happened? All the great powers united to destroy it. Because they knew if the Islamic State had taken over, let's say, Syria and Iraq, they would have had a base to attack everyone and build their great and bountiful Islamic empire that would seek world domination. Imagine if that state had a nuclear weapon. We wouldn't have a world right now.
So it's a big I know it's a bit late in the evening to bring this up as a topic, but I wanted to say this because it came to mind. You're talking about Islam and religion. I'm not a religious person, right? And I know some people might be offended at that. I'm not a Christian. I'm just not. I don't know what anyone's religion on the panel is, but this year I decided to go to church, even though I don't consider myself a Christian. I went to church and I did it for a few weeks in a row. And I've got to be honest, I was very disappointed in the experience. I went along hoping to I don't know. I was looking for some exploration into the big questions about life, and I didn't get that at all. I found it to be very small. I found the service to be almost too rehearsed. The last thing I wanted when I went to a service was to hear the priest talk about Prime Minister's questions, and that's what he did. It seemed to be like a summary of the politics of the week.
What kind of church was this?
This was a Catholic church. It's a local Catholic church in my town.
Yeah.
And look, the majority of the people in there, and by the majority I mean like 99%, were 70 years plus in age. And I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but it felt very childish to me. There was a point where the priest said, okay, now we're all going to get up and we're going to talk to people and we're going to shake each other's hands and bless each other. And it's like, okay.
That's not church. Oh my God. Holy
crap. It felt so manufactured and fake. And I was so disappointed because honestly, I went in there with the best intentions. I wanted to have, it's going to sound corny, but a bit of an awakening, I guess. I'm searching for something greater.
Iconoclast, try an Orthodox liturgy. Like seriously, if you're looking for something that's somber and has a lot of history and is, you know, people aren't going to stand up and, you know, start talking politics or do gay stuff like we're all going to shake each other's hands, try a Greek or Russian Orthodox liturgy.
I'll try.
Must be terrible. I feel for you, man. That's really not the kind of thing you want when you're looking for a sort of deep spiritual experience. Yeah,
I was just so let down. I was like, oh really, is this it? Oh no. Oh, okay, well, yeah, so I just wanted to raise that because you were talking about religion.
I mean, of the four horsemen of the apocalypse from 2007 that came up earlier, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, the blind spot of that group and that project was obviously that we can criticize our own religion, our own cultural identity as much as we like. And yes, it very much subject to the scalpel of logical, philosophical, metaphysical analysis. Unfortunately, it doesn't hold up terribly well. But what I think wasn't anticipated is that when you take that away, you know, what is there now? There's somewhat of a vacuum. And Islam is just as confident as it always has been and will rush in and fill that eagerly. And there was this conspicuous absence of everything else. Now, what you would want to see as someone on the racial right filling that gap would be some sort of racial consciousness, some sort of biological understanding of we are as we are because of our heritable biological traits, because of our DNA. We need to come to some understanding of how our culture is a product of that. As is our neurophysiology and everything else. But we didn't. There weren't those voices plugging in those gaps. There are people such as Jared Taylor who've been doing that for 35 years, but he struggled to get a voice since the 90s in the States, let alone in the UK. And, you know, we haven't had those voices. I don't know woes. I mean, is there someone I'm conspicuously missing that? I suppose maybe Nick Griffin deserves a mention here, but who has been a voice putting forward white racial consciousness or European biological identity as an identity in our public consciousness?
In Britain in the 70s, 80s, 90s.
Yeah, and 2000s even.
Well, in the 2000s, well, it would be Nick Griffin, but
there's a poverty of voices. I mean,
there was Enoch Powell who died in the late 90s, and you know, Tony Blair actually attended his funeral, if I'm not mistaken. I think I'm correct in saying that. So he wasn't completely reviled by then, or at least by that level of society. But I think he still was generally despised. Like the media would speak of him as a racist and all that.
Right.
Mosley, of course, died, I don't know, I think in the 70s. Can't remember.
But you see how back we're looking to try and find a name.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, this is the natural prophylactic to alien cultures and alien bodies rushing in to fill your identity vacuum.
It's
actually identifying who you are and what you are and where your culture came from.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to make a point in regards to this whole situation. One, the biggest problem that the right wing generally has that the left wing politically has down to a T is unity. right? Unity is the greatest strength of socialists and communists, whereas the greatest weakness of conservatives, nationalists, or if you want to use the term fascist, if you want, by European standards. Americans see it completely differently. They think fascism is a left-wing ideology, and I'm like, huh? That's what I
think. I hate all of that. It's so tedious.
So but, that's why I have to put it in terms of by European standards or by American standards. But the point is, what the right wing need is unity. They need to stand together. And what's the best way to unite people? Find a group of people and blame them for everything. it's the easiest way to bring people together and have the courage to do that. On a second point, in regards to Islam, this is very ironic. Those who, in the West, those who oppose Islam the most, ironically would gain the most under an Islamic occupation. Think of it this way. You know, millennial woes, white man, okay? Britain turns into an Islamic caliphate or something, right? He grows a big beard, and as a man, he has special privileges as a Muslim man. He can take many wives. He has to keep an eye on his household. He would basically have a lot of privilege in society. Whereas those in the West who are pushing Islam the most under an Islamic caliphate or an Islamic state would be at best second-class citizens, at worst outright exterminated. So I think that's a very ironic set of circumstances for people to consider. What we need now more than ever is unity. Unfortunately, the murderous political assassination of Charlie Kirk really destroyed the unity of the American right. But what it enabled was, oh, they killed the moderate leader. Now all the radicals can come in and fill the void. And that's why over the past... See, look, a ghost destroyed all my stuff because I'm talking about this. Literally, it all collapsed. But the point is, in order to fill the void left behind by Charlie Kirk, the only thing that can bring people back together on the American right now is find a group of people, blame them for everyone's problems, and go at it, bro. And that's what we're seeing. And I think it's a good thing. Whether it's the Somali issue, the Israeli issue, go at it.
I don't think that, I mean, I take the point. That's the stereotypical leftist thing, is that you just, they blame this group for everything that's wrong. And it's irrational and crazy and hateful. I don't doubt that it works. I mean, I even remember during COVID how the anti-vaxxers were responsible for elongating this plague that was killing granny and so forth. And it was like almost like the 2 minutes fucking hate, where you were encouraged to really despise the anti-vaxxers. I take the point. But I think there is another way to unite people, and that's to unite them in favor of something. The problem we've got, as has been said, I think, by Acceptable Frog, is that the thing we would naturally unite around, and which we did in the first place in late 40s, early 50s, has been completely... made verboten. So I mean, you cannot go there at all.
If you recall Orwell, he describes Winston in the 2 minutes of hate as the feeling of hate engendered by it as being like a blowtorch that could be switched from one object to another. And I think there's something to this, that if people unite around a thing, it's harder to manipulate that thing. Whereas if you get people to hate a certain thing, it's easier to sort of switch the object of that hatred, and it becomes, there's utility in it. This is why I sometimes wonder whether the government doesn't actually desire a certain amount of sort of free-flowing discontent, because it makes people easier to govern in certain ways, because you can just drop like a hate figure or a hate thing sort of in front of them, and like a rabid dog, they'll just go for it. Whereas if the dog was relaxed and calm and well fed, maybe he wouldn't take the bait. This is what I was referencing earlier about like technologies and machinery of governance. Like I don't think that most people really think about the principles of governing or directing large groups of people. And I think they abstract it out to these structures, like my government, my democracy. But, you know, deep down, we are still sort of, you know, mass, you know, I mean, not exactly animals because, you know, we have souls, but...
No, we are animals.
You know, right? There is an entire sort of other side to governing people, as long as you are willing to be completely ruthless and mercenary and have no care for the well-being of the people that you are ruling over. And I think that is a good description to the kind of government that a lot of the West is laboring under at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Ryan, do you want to say something?
Oh, no, I was just cleaning up the thing that fell down, but I'd also like to remind people that my specialty as a content creator wasn't in exploring the discourse, whether it was politics and pop culture. My role was to find new people. I was, in a sense, a recruiter. That's why this guy with a few hundred or a few thousand subs was all on these big shows with hundreds of thousands of subs. Why is he there? I was there to try and find new and fresh talent to keep things from being stale. Because, you know, after a while, same old people, same old talking points, same old topics. People get a bit downcast and it's like, why isn't this moving forward? So a great way for things to move forward in any discourse is to get in some fresh blood, right? I admire Jared Taylor to no end, but let's face it, he's an old guy, and what we need is a new generation Jared Taylor, right? Like the Acceptable Frog, for example, new generation who inspires a new generation to carry it forward. Because unfortunately, folks, we're not immortal. I'm 26. I'll be amazed if I live to 50, especially considering I look like this at 26, folks. There's no hope for me. But I will point out that the way forward is to inspire new generations to do what we do. I think that's why I was specifically targeted to be deplatformed, because what I was doing, no one else was doing in the pop culture scene. In fact, I don't think anyone does it in our spaces, fostering new generations. Let's face it, guys. We're all trying our best to keep our own heads above water, never mind everyone else spinning plates and keeping everyone else in the loop. But that's a little thing that I do, because I know I'm not going to be around forever.
I take the point. But the thing that people forget so often, so easily, is that a high tide raises all ships. And so if you help other people, that also does help you. I know it sounds hippie-ish, but I think it is the truth.
No, fair comment.
All right. So we'll move on to Don said. What?
Just a quick response to something Newsfist brought up, if that's not inappropriate to interject ahead of your super
chat. Go on.
I noticed Newsfist, your hesitation at committing to this comment that we are animals because you don't want to tread on the toes of people with sort of spiritual commitments there. I mean, going back to that, the new atheist movement from a few years ago that's been just come up a couple of times, Sam Harris from that group, ironically, I think has done a lot of good. Also, Richard Dawkins. There's a famous documentary where Richard Dawkins goes off to Father Ted Haggard, to one of these mega churches in the States.
Oh, yeah, I know that guy. Oh.
Right. And there's a famous scene where Dawkins and his film crew are thrown off the property because Ted Haggard's very angry. And Richard Dawkins says, because he said that I'd called his children, his flock, animals. And Richard Dawkins said, which of course was true. You know, I had in a sense that I'd recognize we all have an evolutionary history common to animals, which is quite true. And Sam Harris is one of the few people, I think, who's done some good work pointing out that you can understand this and be absolutely comfortable with that, and at the same time have deep interest in spirituality and in the contemplative tradition. And there's no opposition to those things whatsoever. And I think this was a little underappreciated.
I mean, I guess I just don't want to overstate that aspect. You know, materialism has become such an all-encompassing moral frame for so many people, and it that way lies madness. I mean, you know, this idea that we are only animals, that, you know, we are just completely biologic. Well,
that's a trick of language. You see, the insertion of the word "only" there implies that there's something diminishing or a sacrifice has been made, accepting that you're an animal. You can be an animal and be part of God and part of the universe. There's no inherent conflict in those statements. Is my point there?
I would disagree, right, but that would be a long theological
argument. Let's move on.
There was another point on Sam Harris
for a bit later, but yeah, super chat. Okay.
All right, I just want to get through them because I do have to. The next banquet is due to start in less than 40 minutes, so I've got to think about these things. But okay, Don said yet another wonderful banquet panel. Thank you very much, Don, and Caller. Made a generous super chat and said, I haven't heard any guest on Millennial mention the 2025 Song of the Year by Kanye West. And I'd rather not say the title of it because it will just get clipped and spread everywhere if I say those words. But it refers to a mid-century German political leader. And, so... Does anyone want to talk about Kanye West?
I just want to quickly say that Best said it was the Brother Merry Christmas one that was apparently used in a Chinese mobile phone ad, which is hilarious.
I don't know if it was used in that. It was from this, I think, early in the year, and it referred to a German political leader. I'm not going to say the title because it will just be shared it's everywhere.
It's all right. I thought the song was fantastic, and it was a zeitgeist shift, even if Kanye was off his meds during that whole situation. 2025 is the year the zeitgeist shifted, and we need to capitalize on that into 2026. 2026 is a crucial year. It will either be a year of revival or a year of ruin. 2025 reminds me a lot of 2017, and look where 2017 got us into 2018, 19, 20. If we repeat that in 2025, quote me on this, we will all be completely fucked into 2028, 2029, and 2030. Let us not repeat the same mistakes of the late 2010s. Let us hang together. Otherwise, by the end of this decade, we're all going to be hanged separately, and they're going to need a pretty thick rope for my big body.
all joking aside.
Oh, no.
They got rid of him because he was going to interrupt what I was saying. But no, it's all right. It's all right. Use Brave or Linux, acceptable frog. Use Brave or Linux. Use something else, not Windows.
You're right. Very good advice. No, I didn't think I was. I thought you had finished, Ryan. I didn't want to interrupt you at all. But yeah, only joking aside on the Kanye West song, there's an obvious political social utility to having an increased degree of freedom to discuss World War II revisionism. Yeah, you know, obviously you want to do it in a responsible way, not simply quoting the lyrics of that particular song. But there are people on X, such as Carl Radl, who's a PhD historian, who's doing very thorough, rigorous research into many claims surrounding the Second World War. And, you know, anyone who doesn't have the time of day for that guy is just silly, and they're depriving themselves of an epic history lesson. So to the extent that Kanye made that conversation more accessible and palatable, I think that's a positive thing.
All right, and then we'll move on to Love and Division, who made a very generous super chat, thank you very much, and said, my 99-year-old mother is 100% English. This super chat is just to encourage you guys to keep up the fight. Well, thank you very much, and I think everyone here is quite pumped, and we're ready to keep up the fight.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks very much. And then Nick said, just doing my yearly donation in appreciation of your work. As always, I have but one request. Say at least a few sentences in an American accent. It's a very generous super chat. So I won't do it while I'm on camera because that just feels too exposed. But I will do it during the USA banquet in an hour's time. So thank you for that.
That's a funny thing, Woz. When I'm around British people, they say I sound American. When I'm around American people, they say I sound British. I've been hanging around Americans for so often, I've picked up their accent, and it sickens me as a Welsh person. Everyone comes up to me when I go outside. It's like, are you an American? Are you Canadian? Are you Australian? I'm like, no, lived here. It makes me so uncomfortable, man.
Ryan, there now, I ain't on no camera. All I'm going to say to you is you're not from around here.
Right? As a nationalist, basically the biggest insult you can get as a nationalist is being asked, are you a foreigner?
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, okay, I will honor Nick's request in the next stream. Now, here's a question to end with, because I think it's a good one. And it comes from Reagan, and he asks the following. What does the panel think a positive vision for the future of England looks like? Our side has a tendency to focus on commentating on the losses of the past instead of articulating an alternative. So I'll ask each of you in turn, and then we'll wrap up. So let's start with Acceptable Frog. And what do you think a positive vision for the future of England looks like?
I think a positive vision for the future of Britain involves a continuation of a strong tradition of exploration and discovery and learning and knowledge and science and coming to terms with reality, material reality, which is that our population to date has behaved in the way it's behaved and achieved the things we have, purely by dint of our heritable biological traits and from nothing else. It's not magic. It wasn't beamed into us from aliens. It's not hocus pocus. It's biology. And we either come to terms with that and preserve it or see it disappear. And I think the rival explanations have been shown now to be so inadequate, that there's such a conspicuous poverty of the tabula rasa view of humans and the racial egalitarianism approach. Sooner or later, the average Brit is just going to have to come to terms with that. And we're going to enjoy a natural emergence of a sort of unity, a white racial consciousness, an English racial consciousness. It's bound to emerge, because any other version of the future is so absurd. It's just will require Monty Python levels of denying reality. It won't be sustainable. So I think the future's rosy.
Okay. Iconoclast, positive vision for England's future?
Well, I would echo everything that Frog just said there. And I have this frustration too when people talk, especially politically. They always harp back to the past and, oh, wasn't it so much better back then? And if only we could go back to this. And that annoys me too, because most of modern politics is about what you're against instead of what you're for. And I don't know. I think if you look at what Britain used to be and what the British people used to represent, I do believe we were the best civilization that's ever existed, really. I do. At our peak, I think that's what we were. And now, what is the reason for us to exist? We're just living. We're just hanging on, I suppose. And there's no real drive into the future. There's no real desire to explore, as Acceptable Frog said, and to do things and to go beyond. And I know this is very vague, but I just think we need to push the boundaries a bit. We need to get out there, girl, you know, and do something else. And again, very vague, but I look around and I think, what are we here for? And I don't have an answer for it. But you can harp back to the past all you want and say, yes, that we need to regain those values and how things used to be in this sense or that sense. But 50 years, 100 years from now, what do you want this country to achieve, and what do you want our people to go and do? And I just, it's open-ended for me. I don't really have an answer to the question. I just think that we need to be striving to do more, and that's broad, but that's what I think.
All right. And Newsfist, positive vision for England's future?
I think the whole Anglo-futurism thing is pretty cool in terms of, like, a future vision that people can get behind. But there has to be such severe remolding of the narratives and institutions currently associated with the country. There has to be an abandonment of the blank slate. There has to be a realization that religion is important. Like, you know, and you can't just stock the entire Anglican church with, you know, women and queers and expect it to like function the same way. You know, there's the regime and associated organs love to talk about how, you know, the right wing yearns for an imaginary past, but that's really just, you know, complete cope, because quite honestly, a lot of them would be happy with the 1980s, which is not in any way an imaginary past. What they mean, of course, is that there's no going back. We will not countenance any reversal. I don't know. I mean, the question, I guess, is how much force are they willing to use to prevent reaction? But yeah, I think that if you got a lot of the sort of British Empire aesthetic and you grafted it with the sort of like high tech vision, that could be very, very cool. I don't know which way it's going to go, honestly.
But with that being said, I mean, again, it's easy to say this. Practically, it's different, but literally everything has to change for Britain to have a prosperous future. I mean, it's, again, everything, from the institutions down to the demographics, everything.
Certainly a lot has to be removed.
Well, yes, yeah. Of course. But then again, the people that are left over, they, you know, I mean, we've talked about the boomers a lot. They will die off, you know.
But if we come out, the other side, this period in history will serve as an incredible reminder for why tradition is important, why ethnicity is important, why borders are important. All of these arguments will be answered sort of concisely for possibly the next 100 years, right? Next time someone comes up and they're like, oh, it'd be great if we invited in a million Bamalians, everyone will turn around and just be like, no, it will be immune to it for a while, like the way the Eastern Europeans are basically immune to communism after their experiences with the USSR. So, you know, that is a bit of a white pill. Like if we get through this, none of these arguments will have any traction probably for a century.
Oh, at least a century. And I think they'll be despised. It's not just that they'll have no traction. They'll be despised. It will be social death for someone to recommend this stuff. I remember hearing about Tom Wolfe, the American cultural commentator. Back at the start of my channel, I did a reading of an essay by him where he talks about the great relearning. And he was talking about hippies in the late 60s, and he'd visited some commune or something like that. And they were learning stuff that people hadn't, like STDs were returning that people hadn't seen for centuries. And it was because no one had lived for centuries in the way that the hippies were now living, sharing each other's mattresses, underwear, etc. And so they were learning stuff that common sense could have told them, or ancestral wisdom would have told them. And so that was called the great relearning. And I think what we're seeing now is that, but on a much broader scale, we're now learning why people should get married in their mid-20s, why women should certainly try to have all of the babies they want to have by 35, why homosexuality should probably just be cast aside for most men, and just get married, just have a, what's it called, a lavender marriage, I can't remember what it's called, but that is preferable to the disaster of the rainbow culture that we live in now. And you could say the same about the tomboy to trans pipeline. You know, in every way we're learning that our ancestors were basically right about everything. Is there any exception to that? I don't know if there is. I can't think of one.
You're talking about Chesterton's fence, essentially.
Yes, exactly. We are now learning that the fence was indeed there for a whole range of good reasons. So,
I mean, religion. The religion persisted. Dawkins was often faced with this as a question in Q&As and what have you. How, if it's so bad, how did it persist so, you know, for such a long time? And the standard answer was always, well, you know, it appropriate. It was the only game in town, and it appropriated those. What's the word? Oh gosh, excuse me, mental block. Those
monopoly, captive market.
No, life affirming things. Oh gosh, what are those evolutionarily promoted things? Survival value. Thank you, me. that clearly religion had some sort of survival value in that it appropriated the beliefs and the knowledge. You know, don't eat shellfish; they can make you ill. Gay sex involves, you know, exposure to fecal matter, which carries disease. They didn't have a germ theory of disease, and so the sort of religious prohibitions had a similar sort of survival value.
Thanks and for once, the insights.
And once those things drop away, once the religious commitment drops away, what's the candidate for something to replace that? Well, it's simply a straightforward understanding of biology and of physics. And that's why race realism is the antidote to this. You know, it's just one particular flavor of biological realism. If we simply make friends with biological reality, we solve our racial conflicts, our social problems, our economic problems. I think, yeah, that's where we have to look.
Yeah. So, I think in all sorts of ways this is happening, this great relearning. And thus, as someone else said, this moment, this period in time in history will serve as a blistering rebuke to progressivism of almost every variety, and an affirmation of all that was cast aside after 1945.
It will either be that, right. It will either be a great lesson, or it will be the catastrophic ending. It will be one of those.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It seems to be there's not much middle ground, really. A positive vision. I think we've outlined quite a few variants of that, and basically we just need to recognize what's right in front of us at this point. I don't think there's even need to theorize about it. It's we just need to think what would make a good life, and can we get rid of the 50 factors that are preventing that in Britain today?
Do you want
in
a England Welshman's today? Perspective on how to make England great again?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but maybe be careful about the censors, please.
That's all right. It's very simple, folks, right? How do we save England? The United Kingdom has to end, right? In the same way, how do we save
I agree,
Russia?
Actually.
Yeah. How do we save Russia? The Soviet Union must end, right? How did Russia go from this communist super state to a conservative / nationalist state in 30 odd years? It's because they had to radically transform and greatly weaken themselves in the process. We must do the same thing. There has to be an England, a Scotland, a Wales, and good luck to you, Northern Ireland, surviving Ireland gobbling you up, okay? Best of luck to you. I am of the view that if England is to have a future, it cannot be within the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom is, in a sense, a modern-day Soviet Union now. It has to be broken up. England for the English, Wales for the Welsh, which is, puts me in a very difficult position because two-thirds of Welsh people are English. I know demographic replacement exists because it happened in my country. Welsh people got replaced and have been practically replaced by English people. So it does happen, and it has happened. Scotland for the Scottish, and who knows, Ireland for the Irish. Once the English have control of their own country as England, then it can be fixed. It cannot be fixed under the United Kingdom, because the British identity is essentially Britain, its empire, and its Commonwealth. So essentially, 4 billion people are British. There's no way you can fix that. Break it up. Your own country for your own people, start again from scratch, just like the Soviet Union collapsed and Russia had to literally start from scratch. And in the 90s in Russia, it was not pretty, but they had to do it to save their nation and their people. And England are going to have to do the same thing. And best of luck to you, because the Western world will try to destroy you in the process, just like they're doing with Russia today.
Well, I mean, hopefully by then the Western world as we know it today won't exist. So it will, there won't be the installing of democracy wherever people try to save themselves.
Well, right. As a proud Scottish person, I agree with that.
Scotland. Is there time to fire a quick question at Ryan within the permitted schedule?
No. No. Sure. Sorry.
I understand. I understand.
I've really got to this is a good wrap up, so we're not going to go into more topics.
You know where
now.
To find me, Froggy. You know where find me.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a nice ending. So we'll just wrap up there. This has been great. So thank you to everyone. That's a long banquet, but that's what we were hoping for. So I hope everyone enjoyed it.
Oh God, yes, it okay. has been long, hasn't it? I've just looked at the time. Oh my God.
Yeah. Okay. I'll be back in about 20 minutes with the USA banquet. But in the meantime, Newsfist, Iconoclast, Acceptable Frog, Ryan Roger Athey, and Bo Dade, and of course, Survive the Jive. Thank you all for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you, Wes. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you ever so much for having us. Anyone interested? 13th of January, Jared Taylor and others will be there in a space. Come along for that. Fans of Millennial Woes are welcome.
Okay, thank you very much.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.